All of my life I felt that you were listening, watching for ways to help me stay in tune. A lot of my dreams, although confusion keeps trying to
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, July 27th, 2020. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org, click on our weekly call for instructions on how to join us by phone, app, or browser. Or if anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find the banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. You can click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, we're going to pick back up in the book of Romans, and we're in chapter 15. We're reading the book of Romans, chapter 15. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak, and not to please ourselves. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. For even Christ pleased not himself, but as it was written, the reproaches of them that reproach thee fell on me. For whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, and we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. Now the God of patience and consolation grant you to be like-minded one towards another according to Christ Jesus, that ye may be with one mind and with one mouth glorify God, even the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Wherefore receive you one another as Christ also received us to the glory of God. Now I say that Jesus Christ was a minister of the circumcision for the truth of God to confirm the promise made unto the fathers, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written, for this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles and sing unto thy name. And again he said, rejoice ye Gentiles with his people. And again, praise the Lord, all ye Gentiles, and laud him, all ye people. And again Isaiah saith, there shall be a root of Jesse, and he that shall rise to reign over the Gentiles, in him shall Gentiles trust. Now the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that ye may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Ghost. And I myself also am persuaded of you, my brethren, that ye are also full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able also to admonish one another. Nevertheless, brethren, I have written the more boldly unto you in some sort, as putting you in mind, because of the grace that is given to me of God, that I should be a minister of Jesus Christ to the Gentiles, ministering the gospel of God, that the offering up of the Gentiles might be acceptable, being sanctified by the Holy Ghost. I have, therefore, whereof I may glory through Jesus Christ in those things which pertain to God. For I will not dare to speak of any of those things which Christ hath not wrought by me, to make the Gentiles obedient by word and deed. Though mighty signs and wonders, by the power of the Spirit of God, so that from Jerusalem and round about unto Lycurium, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. Yea, so have I strived to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build upon another man's foundation. But as it is written, to whom he was not spoken of, they shall see, and they that have not heard shall understand. For which cause also I have been much hindered from coming to you. But now, having no more place in these parts, and having a great desire these many years to come unto you. Whensoever I take my journey into Spain, I will come to you, for I trust to see you in my journey, and to be brought on the way thitherward by you, if first I be somewhat filled with your company. But now I go unto Jerusalem to minister unto the saints. For it hath pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are in Jerusalem. It hath pleased them truly, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partners of the spiritual things, their duty is also to minister unto them in carnal things. When therefore I have performed this, and have sealed to them this fruit, I will come by you into Spain. And I am sure that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessings of the gospel of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake, and for the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea, and that my service which I have for Jerusalem may be accepted of the saints, that I may come unto you with joy by the will of God, and may with you be refreshed. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen. That was the book of Romans, chapter 15. Okay, you know, tonight I just want to make an announcement here that, you know, we had filed a complaint, well, not a complaint, we filed an action at law, a little over a month ago against YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and what is the other one? It was for, well, ABC, I think it's called, ABC Incorporated or something like that, that really is the mother company for all of those different internet platforms. Friday, let me think, Friday was the very last day for them to respond. And on Friday, there was nothing in the mail yet, but Saturday morning I did receive papers, and they did mail it out on Friday. And the process, I believe, is that on that 30th day, that last day that they have, as long as it's mailed by that last day, then they've answered. But they really haven't answered. What they did is filed papers for to move into a federal court. We were going through the state court here in New York to pursue that process. For a couple of reasons, sort of a strategy to begin with is to really go through the state courts, and then if we have problems, which we perceive we're going to have some problems, especially in the state courts, and then move it over into the federal court for causes, which is ultimately denial of our right of Second Amendment, and First Amendment, and also due process and many other things. The big battle in the court is going to be the battle of the judge concerning the jurisdiction. We were very clear on our jurisdiction in the paperwork that we filed. We've been in the courts enough now to know most of their games, and I'm sure something new could be possible, but I think we got it down pat on a lot of things that they do. And the way we're going to respond to this is going to be in a way to really, with some insight and realization of what they're going to try next, and sort of to cut things off at the pass, so to speak. The paper we filed, I'm pretty sure we posted it up on our website here. I'm not sure. Let me see. Oh, here it is, down on the bottom. So anybody would like to read the paper we wrote, Action Against YouTube, under Grand Jury, highlight Grand Jury, and come on down to the bottom. It's Action Against YouTube here. And you can go up here and you can read the action that we actually filed. The paper that they filed back, there was three pages from one lawyer, and I think maybe two pages from another lawyer. One lawyer is representing three of the corporations, and the other one representing one. And in any event, you know, I started already working on the response to their response in order to set the stage for the court, so that when we come into the court, that everybody understands, especially the judge, our jurisdiction, and the fact that civil law has nothing to do with the Constitution, has nothing to do with us, and we're also making a big thing about the fact that we're not looking for any summary judgments. We also are going to demand the answer. They have a duty to speak, they have a duty to respond. Rules of civil procedure, civil courts, civil law, or civil law procedures, rules and laws, they are irrelevant in a court of law, which is a common law or natural law court. You know, when we write our paperwork, we try to educate. Most lawyers have no clue what we're talking about because they don't understand common law, and they also have no clue on what common law actually is. As far as they've been taught in bar school, is that common law is a collection of previous court rulings that you apply, you know, in different cases here or there. And that's just not what the U.S. Supreme Court rulings, you know, as far as on the higher levels, but on rulings for any case that has gone before a court. If you're in the state court, they'll pursue lots of court decisions. Could be within the state, could be in other states, could be on the federal level, so on and so forth. And they'll use that to position themselves to build a case and using past case for precedences in order to win their case. And that's not what justice is about. Justice has nothing to do with precedence. Justice has everything to do with truth and justice, period. And so we do try to, you know, make sure that we give them a little bit of an education, mostly through footnotes. And we make our position, and again, our positions, these lawyers have never seen before. They don't know how to respond. But we don't know when the case, the hearing is going to be, because they're calling for a hearing. It's going to be in the Southern District of New York, which is Westchester County. It's White Plains, I believe, which is in Westchester County, but it's in White Plains. And we're asking anybody that could possibly attend that hearing to show up there. The case is the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury against Alphabet Inc., Google, Facebook, and Twitter. And we did copy the president on this. We did copy William Barr on this, Attorney General. Again, I think we wrote a pretty good paper on this. It's not too long. It totals 122 pages, but that's with the attachments. The paper itself, let me see how many pages it is. It's 20 pages, so it's a 20-page action. And then, of course, we have lots of attachments. And it's a verified action, which means it was sworn to. So it in itself acts as the affidavit. You know, without an affidavit, you cannot open a court. And so an affidavit is always required. Someone has to swear something to some, you know, about something. So anyway, it's going to be, the case is going to be, have a hearing. I think it's going to be interesting. I'm hoping to finish the paper up tomorrow and get it out before the end of the day or worse, maybe on Wednesday. But we are going to respond to some of the things that they're doing. We're going, again, as I mentioned, lay out the plan on so that the court understands the jurisdiction that we're in and some of the things they're trying to lean upon. One of the things, of course, we want to talk about to them is the fact that, hey, these people didn't answer. They defaulted. They didn't get leave of court. As a matter of fact, I'm going to talk with, Brent. Brent, are you here? Did anyone see Brent yet? Terry, have you seen Brent yet?
No, I have not.
Okay. All right, I'll save that for him to talk a little bit about that. I'm not sure exactly, and this has happened numerous times to us, but they always try to kick you out of court or they move you into the federal court. So if you're going up against, for instance, individuals that are working in the federal government, and, you know, when I do a suit, you know, I don't necessarily sue the agency because the agency is one thing, but we sue the individuals. Once you sue the agency, you're suing the people, you're suing a government agency, but we're suing people that have stepped outside their authority, stepped outside their jurisdiction, and has caused injury. But in any event, they always try to throw the case out under Rule 12, and that's one of the things they do. They claim failure to state a viable claim or something like that. I forget what the wording is on that. But in any event, they usually try to throw us out on that. And the judge usually goes along with that, maintaining the status quo and power you out of the court. The key to keep the court case going is to counteract those things with a powerful argument. And of course, when you miss something, then that's how they get you out of there. But again, we've got a lot of experience in this, and I think we've got all the cases covered. It's going to be very interesting. We're going to make it clear to the judge that's trying to stick their toes into our court that if they were to injure us, or moving us into jurisdictions unknown, we don't have to go to an appeal. We have the power and the authority to sue that court directly, which we'd go right after the judge and anybody else connected with that. In that case, probably the lawyers too, because they would be conspiring and planning and working with the judge in order to move us into jurisdictions unknown, which they call civil law. But we're under common law. And as far as we do use a lot of United States Supreme Court rulings, particular rulings that have withstood time, very powerful in authority because it's very common lawish, if I might use that kind of a term. It's self-evident truths. And what has built in our nation what's called American jurisprudence. All equity courts are to go and are to proceed under American jurisprudence. So when you have a judge from an equity court trying to take control of a law court, which he has no power or authority to do, law courts are run by the people. You have a magistrate in that court, whereas they act as a traffic cop to keep things moving along. All judges are magistrates, so as long as he's got his magistrate cap on, that's okay. But once that judge starts to make decisions, that's when you have to stop them. And if we fail to stop them, then of course they continue on, and that becomes the decision-making process of the case, especially in the federal court. Because when you're in a federal court, there are 57 potential jurisdictions. Okay, because there are 57 different USCs, U.S. codes. And as the conversation moves, you move from one jurisdiction to another. Okay, we must maintain the jurisdiction of law, and judges are not permitted to make any summary decisions. They're going to try to rest in a code that was written concerning particularly online activities where, I forget the number of that code. I should have made some notes on that. But we'll probably talk a little bit about that maybe next week. But after we file the paper, we'll look at the paper a little bit. But the code that they're relying on is a code that sort of protects them from lawsuits. And to some degree, it's good, but it is kind of clear, I think. They're talking about pornography particularly. Things that, that kind of a thing that should not be going forward on the Internet as far as on open view. But in any event, we're working through that code, that information right now, and it's pretty consistent that it's focusing in on lewd situations, pornography particularly, anything with it's focusing in, again, on pornography. Now, they're trying to make the case, and I can see where some of the words that they're trying to use, that it gives them the power and the authority to decide on whatever they want to cut off and just disconnect from the Internet. In other words, not post your video, bury it, not allow certain statements to be made or positions to be made. We had a thing, as a matter of fact, on our front page. Go to the front page we have here. We posted last week or so a couple of videos on our front page, since then they've taken one down. The one that they took down was this one right here, and it was on face masks, very powerful, about 15 minutes, but it's been removed from the Internet because they have decided that that's not a good thing for you to see, you know. And the other one we did post was this one by a doctor, Richard Barlett. Okay, very powerful. They didn't take this one down yet. So if you haven't seen this video, you should get up there and see it before they take it down. This is another one here. This is Tom Woods. Those of us who have taken our civics course is familiar with Thomas Woods. He's a professor of history, I think. He teaches particularly American history. I think we have about 19 lectures of his. We had a lot of lectures of his. He does a really good job taking us through American history. And again, people should be taking our civics course, and you'll get to see those those lectures. But in any event, he did this. I wouldn't call it a lecture, but maybe it is a lecture. The Fact-Free Lockdown Hysteria. By Thomas Woods. Very powerful, very good. Gerard shared another video with me today, which I haven't been able to post yet. I really haven't been able to watch it yet, but he told me it was a good one concerning these things, so we'll get it posted up there again. I don't normally put these kind of things on our front page. We've got lots of places to put videos. Eventually, we will move these videos someplace else, but because it's pertinent today, it is really the front line of our battle here against the deep state. We've got it up on our front page for right now. We do have quite a few videos on our front page too, but most of them they're all focusing in on the work we're doing, what we're doing with either, the courts or the committee men, different things, sheriffs. So we have a lot of PowerPoint videos on those particular subject matters or items that we put on. Okay, let's see. So anyway, we will post the answer during the week to this paper. We will post it up where, let me get to that other page where we were, so just back here. Okay, under grand jury, action against YouTube. We'll post it right there. So we have this. We'll also post a copy of the papers that they wrote. And so we'll have all that up, and I think we'll discuss it a little bit next week, get into more details of the specifics, talk about the sneaky plans that they have. And I see what they're doing in their paperwork already. I see exactly where they're going, and so we're going to be cutting them off, so to speak, at the pass before they really even get there. And we're going to put the judge not only on notice, but into a very precarious position. It's going to be a little risky for him, I think, because we will sue him if he violates our right of due process and tries to hijack into jurisdictions unknown. In this case, they call all these jurisdictions civil law, and they all have their own codes. Like I said, there are 57 different jurisdictions on the federal level. But it's going to be interesting to see how it goes. We did sue them for a lot of money. A lot of money, and if we win on this, of course, we're going to be hiring a lot of people and putting people to work, but I'm not going to count on this. At some point, that kind of thing is going to happen later, because we have to maintain a presence for the purpose of teaching people not only the common law, but our history and heritage, and the processes of the grand jury and the trial jury and the administrations of the same, and also the committee men process and the militia and organizing across the nation, and so on and so forth. But we did sue them for a lot of money. Originally, I threw up the idea, we'll go after $1 billion for it, because they're a big company. When I looked into it, they're almost a $1 trillion company when you put them all together. And they all these companies are connected one way or another. Three of them are owned directly by, three of them are owned directly by that corporation, Alphabet Inc., I think it's called. Yeah, Alphabet Inc., okay. So we have Facebook, Google, YouTube, and that's owned by Alphabet Inc. Twitter is owned as a different company, but there seems to be a connection between them. But between them all, they're almost a $1 trillion corporation. So after discussing it with others, we decided, well, we're going to assume for $4 billion. And, again, that money will be used for the sole purpose of of educating the people. And boy, with that kind of money, there's so much we can do, so many things we can do with that kind of money to get our message out and to educate people. But meanwhile, we'll continue going forward with what we got, you know, on a shoestring type thing. Okay, with that, I guess we'll move over to questions. Do we have any questions, Terry or Jan? I don't see Jan here.
I see a lot of questions. Jan asked me to help with it tonight.
Okay.
I see a lot of questions, and I have two lists. I got what I had for questions, and then Jan gave me some that I'm not exactly sure where they all came from. I think we discussed that one last week. I would appreciate some help on this. I know from our Texas Constitution and statutes that our county sheriff has no chain of command and as an elected official answer only to the people who elect him. Therefore, he is indeed the chief law enforcement officer in the county. The problem is that over the last 25 years, I have been, without checking till now, accepting the phrase, SCOTUS has ruled. And now I have reason to quote that ruling. I cannot find anywhere that SCOTUS has actually made that ruling. Even on our Liberty Alliance website, there is no clear-cut quote and the case site being used. Quote, he is also the chief conservator of the peace within his territory jurisdiction. Harston versus Langston, Texas Civil, et cetera, et cetera. Doesn't stand up as proof because it is a site of a case that was filed, adjudicated, appealed, and affirmed, all evidently without ever reaching SCOTUS. At least I can find no documentation of it. Is there anywhere, to your knowledge, where a quote can be found that says that SCOTUS has ruled on the power of the sheriff, using those words, not through assumption? I am dealing with people who will insist on counting the hairs on an ant's lip before conceding that an ant has a mustache.
All right. Well, we do cover that. It is on our website. I'm not sure. I don't know that the actual full case is up there, but we do have the case, the quotes, and the quotes on the case, and also you know, the information to lead you to that case. It's a case with Sheriff Mack and a couple other sheriffs who actually did brought the lawsuit in and ended up before the United States Supreme Court. And they did make a decision very clearly that the sheriff is the top law enforcement of a county, and that all answer to him. It was a very powerful decision, a lot of different information. Terry, can you mute your mic as I'm talking, because I'm hearing a repeat.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, we do have that. It is in my book. As a matter of fact, I just recently, past week, I've been buried in my book, going through it, looking for any kind of more corrections that could be made. You know, as time goes on, you learn new things, and then you find you got to correct a little error here or there, and I did that in my book, so it's up to date, at least to my knowledge at this point in time, on that end. And I got a little rid of a lot of redundancies and a lot of different things. I just cleaned the book up and restructured some of it and moved some things around. Some things were repetitive, so I pulled some repetitiveness out and so on. But in the book, we do focus in on a quote when we deal with the sheriff concerning that, as far as the sheriff being the top cop and what the conclusion of that case was. And we do give the information. You also will find that case, I'm pretty sure, inside of our course, our civics course. There's another place you'd probably find it, and that would be, let me see if I can get here from there, well, there from here, shall I say, go to People's Duty, County Sheriff. You go to the County Sheriff page, I believe we have it, okay, underneath People's Duty. Click on Power of the Sheriff. And we have Downloading the Sheriff's Handbook, which this is going to be updated because we just rewrote a lot of, we wrote an administrative book, which we're going to be posting very soon. We hopefully will be finalizing it tomorrow, even tomorrow afternoon. We have a meeting with certain groups of people within our structure here of National Liberty Alliance, and that's the major part of our discussion. We've been reviewing through the administrative book that we wrote. We wrote a book on the administrative book for jury administrators, sheriffs, and coordinators, and coroners. That's one book. It's a handbook, but it's about 40 pages, and we will create a regular pocket handbook out of it eventually. We also wrote another book for a grand jury, and that, I think, is pretty much done. We'll be looking at that to probably clean that up, finalize over the week, maybe next week, maybe on next Tuesday we'll take a look at that and hopefully finalize it. We also did the same thing on the jury, the Pettit jury, wrote a book on that. We also did a questionnaire, which we're still brainstorming that on the jurist grant questionnaire. What type of questions should be asked to the individuals that are coming together for the purpose of a grand jury or a trial jury? And that questionnaire, we're going to post all these things shortly. I think within the next 2 weeks, we will probably have it all posted. Now, there's another book that I've been working on a little bit here or there over the past few years, but it's not in any kind of a form yet as a booklet. But I think after these books are put up, maybe we'll take another week or two to get that book together. And that book is going to be a detailed book, a handbook, very specifically for people who are administrators for the juries. Very detailed information on how to proceed, how to orientate the jury, making sure that we lay out certain rules or restrictions so that we don't ourselves end up tainting the jury ourselves in any way, being very, very careful how we speak to the jury. Also on how we will assist in the writing of the indictments. The indictment is signed by the jury foreman, but someone has to write it. We're going to see how that works. Definitely, the administrators will be part of that, and make sure it's written correctly, and not in any abusive manner, and not in any way that adds things that the jury is not part of the jury's will. But anyway, I'm not going to get too much into discussion of that because we haven't structured that yet. But that's another book that'll be done, and that'll be posted up there. As far as my book, Consent of Government, it's about 700 pages, and I got it into a publisher right now. I'm communicating with them. Hopefully, I'll be able to get the book published soon. Worst comes to worst, I'll print it by taking it up on it's called self-publishing, but it's really printing at that point. But I prefer getting a publisher if I can, because that'll get it out into the bookstores. They spend a lot of time and money, getting your book out there. And so if you pick up a publisher, that means the publisher feels pretty confident that they're going to be able to make money on this thing. I feel good that we will probably be able to land one. But that book hopefully will be coming out soon, as soon as I can get a publisher. It is complete. Like I said, the past week I've spent working on that. But going back into the sheriff's handbook, let me see if I can run a control find. Chief.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention on that question, they said, where does
Here it
say?
Is. Yeah, hold on. Sheriff is the chief law enforcement officer of the county, and that's on page 12. Okay. But go ahead. Here it is. Sheriff is the chief law enforcement of the county. The sheriff, this is a case... couple of cases, and here's one with the one with Justice Scalia writing for the majority in a 1997 decision said that the states are not subject to the federal direction, and that U.S. Congress only had discrete and enumerated powers, and that federal impotency was rendered express by the 10th Amendment. Let me see if I can. Just skip ahead a little bit here. Constitution protects us. Anyway, in here you will find it. But Gerard, did you want to respond on this?
Well, they want to know where the state Supreme Court, where the SCOTUS said that the president, there was a case that came up, but SCOTUS is not the arbitrator of who's in charge of who's. The president, the sheriff is older than the Supreme Court.
And, well, that's true in common law.
You know, he's in. That's right. He's in the Magna Carta. And
yeah, but it is good to have a Supreme Court ruling.
Absolutely, but that does. Everybody thinks the Supreme Court runs everything, and that is not true. They're not. They don't rule. I mean, we got three co-equal branches of government. The Supreme Court is not over the other branches of government. They can have an opinion, just like Brent has said many, many times on here, that there's a battle between them, and we don't depend on this. The president doesn't necessarily get permission from the Supreme Court or depend on him. I know he goes back in there for opinions all the time, but he doesn't get his power due to the Supreme Court. You know, he gets it by virtue of the people, what we bequeath it to him. And the sheriff is a traditional, you know, office that's been there since, you know, it came up through since 1215 in the Magna Carta, the Shire of the Reef. Anyway, you know, I just wanted to make it clear that the Supreme Court is not the rulers of the other branch of government, and you don't necessarily need a ruling from the Supreme Court to give somebody authority.
Well, that is absolutely true, but you do need a ruling from the Supreme Court to keep the federal agencies in check, and that's exactly what happened with this case from Scalia.
Yeah.
To us, it doesn't mean anything. Well, it does. It's helpful. But it really is not that important. Even if we don't have anything like that, that doesn't mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that the sheriff is the top cop. He's been around for 1,000 years, and he's been with here in America since its inception and before its inception, as a matter of fact. And so the history is very rich of the sheriff. There's a connection with the sheriff and the common law. You cannot separate that. You have to have a sheriff. It's part of the common law process, because that is the sole law enforcer that answers only, really, to the people themselves.
Right. He's elected by the people. He answers
the Constitution.
To the people.
So people need to realize, and this is what we really try to teach people here at National Liberty Alliance. We focus very much so on the book and in our courses, is the fact that the sovereign makes the law, and you are that sovereign. Okay, there are two laws ultimately that we have ordained here in the United States under and through the Constitution. One is law, which is common law or natural law, and that, of course, is written by God. It's written in the hearts of men. We pursue it with self-evident truths, which are the rules of the common law. Rules of the common law are self-evident truths. Okay, and even our existing court system continues with some of these self-evident truths that are common law rules, but they don't really live up to them, but they do bring them up, and that is, for instance, an individual person is innocent until proven guilty. For every injury, there must be a remedy. You know, those kind of things. Those are self-evident truths. Those are the rules of the common law, and those are the rules that we, the people, need to be under. So that's the one place where we the people are under the law. Now, the law, there's also equity. Now, equity is what's called positive law, okay? Positive law is what is ultimately anything that would be put up as positive law would refer back to a lawful legislative law. And lawful legislative law has a process where the authority comes from. It comes from God to the people, and that is the covenant we made with God to the Declaration of Independence and the command that God gave us back in the garden, you know, to subdue. And there's many things throughout the Bible which gives the power of the people to have the power and the authority to rule themselves. And that's how we came to be as a nation. Only one other nation had done this before. Although there's dramatic tribes that lived under these kind of rules, similar to this, and that's what Jefferson picked up on, and he also picked up on the Exodus and Moses, and when the whole structure was set up on government by the people. And the United States is that second nation. And so it comes back from God to the people, and then the people through a constitution to our government. So we have government by consent through our constitution, but we also have action. We have a place to have action. We have a place that we can apply our power and authority, and that's through the jury and through the committee men. The committee men are the people who put all of these people that get elected onto the ballot. And right now, you know, there are no elected committee men that we're aware of anywhere in the United States. We're not. There may be some here or there, but we haven't found them. And I'll bet you the ones that may be still elected, they probably don't even understand their power and authority, because again, they're fed pablum and lies and are controlled. But if we had, if the people had the knowledge of their power and authority, and became elected committee men and understood their power and authority through that elected committee men, then we would indeed be able to control 100% of our government's activity by putting them on the spot, really. First of all, we can require them to have knowledge of the Constitution, and if they don't, we can require them to go learn before they come back and ask to be put on a ballot for whatever position they're going for, and that would include even dog catcher. Everyone that is elected must understand the Constitution, must know the Constitution. And so that's the power of the committee man to make the choices of the people, to put statesmen onto the ballot. So we're not the criminal on the right or the criminal on the left, but the statesmen on the right or the statesmen on the left. And actually, in reality, going back to the way it was in the days of George Washington and Jefferson, and they both spoke about this, they both hated the parties, although Jefferson was involved with the name of being Republicans in order to identify himself against the Federalist, and he felt that he was a Federalist also, because he believed in creating this federal federation and to bring the states together. That was robbed by the other group, and he found a lot of problems, along with James Madison, found a lot of problems with the Constitution. It was written very well, a lot of good things, but there were things in there that were not very good because it could be taken in the wrong way. And the clarification of that really comes through the unique edition, which is called the Bill of Rights, which is very short, but so powerful, because you see, in order to read the Constitution, if you read the Constitution in light of our unalienable rights, that they must not and may not be violated, okay? So if you read the Constitution in light of the Bill of Rights, then that puts a check on people trying to take the Constitution in order to give themselves more power to go this way or that way. So anything that is, and Madison, Marbury versus Madison, cleared it up very quickly, one of the first great court cases. I think it was actually the first court case heard by the United States Supreme Court, Marbury versus Madison. And, you know, anything repugnant to the Constitution is null and void. It's as if it never was. You know, you can continue in whatever it is that they're trying to prevent you from doing because you have an unalienable right to do so. People need to understand that they are the law writers. We, the people, ordained and established this Constitution for them. In the preamble, we gave, six directives to our government. And they were to fulfill, so whatever they did had to fulfill one of those directives. And that's in the preamble of the Constitution. And one of the jobs that is the duty of the government is to protect our liberty, and it speaks of liberty. It talks about the blessings of liberty, to protect the blessings of liberty. Okay, and how do you protect the blessings of liberty? Justice, law, and order. That's how you protect the blessings of liberty. If we have just courts, we will have a just government, and if we have a just government, our just government will deal with the rest of the world in a just way. And the people will be focused on justice, and children will be taught justice. And if that's what we have, then God, of course, blesses us for that. That's the blessings of liberty. So we have to make sure that justice prevails in our courts and stems out from there, right down, you know, right into the streets, right into the people. And if we fail, if government fails to do that, which they have, and the people have lost that and are ignorant to that fact, and that's why we haven't really been very blessed. But I think times they are changing. I think things are moving in a different direction. And we have a duty to teach each other the truth and justice and to make sure our children learn these things in school. When our children, we don't want to teach. We need to teach our children not what to think, but how to think. We have to give them a classical education. But we have to bring, our founding fathers, our heritage, our rich, rich heritage into the schools. And our children need to know these founding fathers, who they were as a people, what they believed, and how this whole nation formed, and how the Constitution was formed, and the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, how they discovered their repentance from slavery, and so on. As a matter of fact, that was one of the things I had missed in my book, was to address slavery in America. And like I said, this past week I've been working on it, and I did some additions, and I think I wrote about 14 or 15 pages on that. I did some good research and blown away. I'm just blown away on how far away from the truth of what really took place back then. Our founding fathers worked diligently to end slavery. Slavery was here before we became a nation. It was we were a British colony, so we were colonies governed by Britain. And we're under their law, and they brought slaves in. They came in the 1500s. Slaves, sometime, they're not sure exactly when it started, but sometime in the 1500s it came through. And by the time maybe three-quarters of the way through the 1600s, in the 17th century there, we had the Great Awakening started. And that was really a lot of people, philosophers and religious people looking in to truth, and you have Blackstone and all those individuals, and they wrote on common law, and they brought a lot of things together and had a lot of debates and teaching about humanity, and it is in there where a lot was discovered concerning who we are as a nation. A lot has been drawn from that, but it's the Great Awakening, which connects us to God, by the way. You can't have that Great Awakening without God. Remove God, then there is no Great Awakening. It's the essence of the whole thing. And that we have unalienable rights. We don't have human rights. We don't have civil rights. We don't have constitutional rights. We have unalienable rights. And it's a big deal to make that point. That point must be made. People need to understand that. But we are the lawmakers. We wrote the law. We wrote the Constitution. We, the people, ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. And we've laid the whole thing out. And therefore, since we wrote it, we gave them the authority to write statutes and codes and regulations for the different government agencies on a federal level and on the state level. You know, it's the same thing, just the state levels or the federal level. And so we gave them all that power and authority, but we never gave up our sovereignty. There is absolutely nothing they can write in law and hold against us that we have to obey anything that they write. And full power and authority of that law is given to every jury that comes in. And we wrote a large section on this in the book also, about the power and the authority of the juries. And also in our paperwork that we've written the two booklets, again, the jurist handbooks and the grand jurist handbook. and so there's a lot of power and authority in the people, the power to nullify, okay? And as a matter of fact, and we're going to talk about that in our case, in the paper that we're going to write and respond to, if the judge thinks he can come in and make a decision on something that is written in code, we're going to make it quite clear to him. He doesn't have that power. He doesn't have that authority. That's not for him to have. This is a court of law, and that's for the people to decide whether they like that law or not, not to some judge to decide whether they like that law or not. And you see, until people start thinking on this level and in this way, and the only, you have to become educated in this area. You have to become familiar with all of these things, how the justice system works, what the law really is, what is common law. And again, getting right back to our heritage and the construction of this country, the three foundational papers that created this nation. And And until people get familiar with that, they can't really think in a true free way, and to the point where they understand that they are sovereign, that they are above all law except God's law. You know, we're under God. Everyone's under God's law, okay, and nothing could be changed there. But as far as the 57 codes, or there, if you go into Black's Law has 51 jurisdictions. That's what I counted, 51 jurisdictions. I could be off one or two, but I'm pretty confident in that. 51 jurisdictions is found in Black's Law. And 50 of them are under civil law or equity. Well, let me backtrack on that. 49 of them are under civil law. One is under true equity, and the other one is common law, referred to in Black's Law and other dictionaries. Going back, the older one, Bouvier's dictionary, for instance, in Black's Law, of course, refers to always the common law. Whenever you read about law, in law, at law, that's natural law. That's common law. But again, positive law or equity, proper positive law that is equity, that is law through proper authority. And right now in the entire world, and probably, well, yeah, until going all the way back to 1600 BC, where we Mosaic law we have, and the first common law nation was brought to be, going all the way back then, we had the common law, and today we're the only nation that has common law and a lawful equity law, because we're the only one with a constitution written by the people, puts the government underneath the constitution, therefore underneath the people, and they can make no law to govern as far as the behavior of the people. They have no power or authority to do that. They have no power or authority to charge us for a right, to license a right, or to prevent us from exercising a right. And they're getting away with all this because we, the people, are ignorant. I speak to myself first. You know, we're ignorant to these things. So we need to become familiar with them and start thinking outside of the box and realize that we are not inside the box at all. We are the lawmakers. And when we are jurists, need to understand they're coming in with extreme amount of power, the power to rule, overrule any court in this nation, because that they're the final word. As long as they don't injure another individual in their ruling, you know, by injuring someone's one of someone's unalienable rights, as long as they don't do that, their decision is final. They can overrule anything. Let's take a case. If a case ended up into the courts, they try to pull that real quick in today's environment. But let's take a case on abortion if it were to enter into the law courts, which is where it belongs, because abortion is nothing to do with equity. It's under law. And when the United States Supreme Court decided to make a decision in Roe versus Wade, they were stepping on God's toes. They entered in his domain. They changed. They think they had the power and the authority, and the Bible speaks about this, the power and the part and the authority to change the law, okay, to make murder legal. Now, some people may get very upset about that because that's how they were brought up in their mindset in their own environment. Our founding fathers were brought up in a slavery mindset, and they struggled with that. Most of them struggled with it when they were young. Jefferson particularly struggled with it because at age 14, he started struggling with it because the burden of slaves were put upon him when his father died at age 14, and he inherited the slaves. And so he pondered this at a very young age, and some of our founding fathers did also. Benjamin Franklin, a very interesting story about him. I'll leave that. It's in the book. I won't get into that tonight, but a very interesting story about him and his thoughts and ideas about slavery and how he was turned. George Washington was turned. All of these men, by the Great Awakening, and this was stimulated, as a matter of fact, this was the original stimulation of the conversation of that day, the narrative of that day, was driven by Benjamin Franklin, because he was a printer and he was printing out all these papers and getting it out into the public and getting discussions going, the political discussions and going on throughout the nation. of course, in his own little town, and it spread out to the colonies. Okay, and so he had the narrative going, and it was Jefferson who really brought the conversation into the Great Awakening, and all of our founding fathers found themselves in that conversation, in that narrative, and they had to deal with slavery. Okay, so all these people that talk about how horrible our founding fathers were, oh, they're slave owners. No, they have no idea what they're talking about. They were born into that situation. And when the United States of America was created, in the book, I found the actual writing that Jefferson had written concerning slavery and King George and liberty of all men. Of course, that was watered down and changed because they felt they didn't want the colonies to break up. Anyway, there's a lot to the story. It's interesting. I think I got about 15 pages on it. And Jefferson's journey trying to end slavery from a very young age, his first action in the political world, he was sent, I think it was 1774, I think maybe, I don't remember the year exactly. He was sent to the legislation for Virginia, and his first act, he knew he couldn't push anything through to end slavery, but he started off on the low end of things, saying, you know, that trying to make it legal in Virginia to emancipate a slave. So Jefferson didn't free his slaves because he couldn't, and he refused. He refused to sell his slaves. He refused to give them up to another individual. So that's why he kept his slaves. Benjamin Franklin, Benjamin Franklin's Philadelphia, and there were slaves there, but it wasn't that widespread up in the northern part of places. But I believe it was Benjamin Franklin actually taught his slaves to read and write. And he only had a few slaves. And again, all of our founding fathers were born into this, and when they went through the Enlightenment, they repented and started to build a nation that would not have slavery. And it took all the way to Lincoln, okay, really get to that point where, to some degree, they were free. But even after that, the battle goes on. And hopefully today, with the narrative out there and the things that Trump is doing, hopefully today we will bring that to a total rest, hopefully, where we can live and forget that past, not remember it, not forget it, remember it, but to realize that we did indeed have a correction, and all men are created equal, and we should try to wipe out prejudice as much as we can. We'll never get rid of it from everyone, but we should have the majority not being prejudiced. So, okay, by the way, where are we? We're asking questions. I guess I went on too long.
Hey, when Jefferson taught his slaves how to read and write, that was against the law.
No, Jefferson didn't do that. Benjamin Franklin did that. Well, and
Franklin,
yes, it was
still,
against
it
the
was
law.
It was against the law to teach
not
them
for
to
him.
Write.
Not for him. He was in Pennsylvania, so the law wasn't like that in Pennsylvania. Virginia's law was you couldn't emancipate a slave. You couldn't treat them. Matter of fact, Benjamin Franklin thought that they were unteachable. Okay, and he looked at the black man very differently, you know, as different from most from people ultimately, and there was someone who enlightened him on that, and they brought him to a place where they were teaching black children, and his whole mindset changed when he went there. You see, people are the environment. We are what we're born into. You know, there's certain things we're kind of lean to, genetically speaking, I think you can say. But most of who we are and what we are to some degree, okay, is in the environment that we grow up in. And then the ability of our mindset at some point in time after the age of reason, when we come to the age of reason, we're able to start thinking things out. And we're able to, if we're brought up in an environment where we're taught self-control, we could start changing our bad habits and making ourselves better and think better things and so on and so forth.
The proper science on heredity is not that people mutate and change. It's that it's in there already. It's in your DNA, and your environment determines what part of your heredity is expressed. So like you said, when you put them in a certain environment, then that heredity that God already put in there that comes from your ancestors, then it's expressed. But it depends on the environment you're in. So,
well, that's the key. And, you know, well, the key, in my very strong opinion, is going to Christ, because, you know, when you go there, He leads you through all things. He gives you a proper mindset, a proper focus on morality, a desire to learn and do the will of God, to start to repent and turn from the things you're doing that is wrong and start doing the right things. You know, to me, that takes a blessing from God to have that state of mind. I don't know that very few people, if they can, come to achieve something like that. But nevertheless, you know, we're all screwed up in our childhood to some degree. You know, we get messed up here or there, problems in the school, problems here or there, problems in your own home. And when we get older, hopefully we can kind of straighten that out by really thinking out our problems and looking for the right way to go forward. All right, well, let's get back on point. Next question. And by the way, Terry, your mic is off, but if you see Brent come in, let me know.
Oh, will do. Okay, I received a phone call from your organization regarding DCS completely steamrolling my daughter and my granddaughter's constitutional rights. I have been on this day and night and can find no one to listen. I'm ready to hold them accountable. They have no accountability. I have had three public defenders removed. We are in termination now, and not one motion, answer, or any cross-examination has taken place, even though it's been requested. The judge is rubber-stamping everything. I am ready to start communicating with others that have or are dealing with this. I have spent hours studying the law and have what I think is a better grasp on it than those 20-something caseworkers. Can you help? He's got more, but it's all details of the case.
Well, look, at those caseworkers, they don't really know the law at all anyway, so they have no clue. And lawyers, they don't know the common law, the natural law. And it sounds like they're stuck in family court and all of that stuff. Yeah, look, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. It's hard to get out. You need to become educated first and foremost, because you have to have the knowledge to make the decisions on what your next step is, and you want to have good knowledge, and hopefully that's what we provide here. We believe that we do provide that here. So here at National Liberty Alliance, the first step is to get educated. The next thing is to work with other people, like-minded people in your county, to start to build on the grassroots level. And at some point, we suggest when you have between 6 and 12 people, that's about, and you're organized well enough, and we do have a plan of organizing. Okay, again, National Liberty Alliance, underneath People's Duty, organizing your county. You click on that. Step-by-step details on organizing your county. Now, we don't have the full plan yet, and we're going to write it. I don't know whether I'll be able to get to this week, but if not this week, maybe next week. We have to write a plan on approaching the sheriff. I have information put together, you know, notes that I've thrown together here or there on the subject matter, but we have to write a plan on how to approach the sheriff. But before you approach the sheriff, because you got to get the sheriff on board, and you got to create a system, a situation in such a way that he can't resist you, okay? And he'll understand, he becomes more powerful by participating with you. And that's what we have to show the sheriff. We have to show the sheriff that we're in the law, and that you know, we're not some crazies or anything going you know, to the extremes. But we're actually working within the common, the natural law, which is exactly where we need to be. And the power and the authority of the sheriff and the knowledge we can give him concerning the Constitution. We need to bring that sheriff to the realization, to the question, did he lie? When he raised his hand and took his oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, did he lie when he did that? Because if he didn't know what his duty was to do it, he did lie, because he took an oath on something he didn't even understand, or she didn't even understand. We have to bring the sheriffs to come to realize they need an education. They cannot depend on the county defender or county, the county attorney. they can't depend on that. They have to depend on themselves. They are the interpreter. And it's in plain language. As Jefferson spoke about all this, this is all plain language. This is not mumbo-jumbo, you know, legalese. No, it's plain language, plainly, easily understood. And that's what the sheriff has to do. He has to become freed from the shackles of the law that he's under right now, because to a lot of degree he's controlled by the civil law. But anyway, we have to connect with our sheriff. So we're going to write a plan on that, on how to make that, how that conversation should start and how to start it, and give a few ideas, and people can add their own flavor into that, but we can give them a process. But you have to be structured first. You have to have a proper structure with resolutions. You set up like a committee. You need, we're suggesting 6 to 12 people before you approach the sheriff, but to be structured properly. You know, there's a lot of stuff in here. So anyway, we'll add that to this page once we get that written up. But here it is, organizing your county, creating a committee, a chairman, a co-chairman, a treasurer, a secretary, different venues, places you can go. Libraries are great, town halls are great, a private club is great. But you can even use the back room of a bar or a restaurant or a diner. I mean, there's lots of places you can have, a lot of venues out there. You should have an online venue. I'm not going to go through all this. We have gone through this before. But this is the plan to organize your county. And that's where you need to start, because you need to have people behind you, people who understand what you're talking about, and people who can help step up and defend you with you. And of course, the best thing you can have is a sheriff on your side and other people in the community that become knowledgeable of these things. And as we take back the courts and create the administrators for the court, for the people to take back the ownership, the rightful control of our courts, and by and for the people, period. And also the political system, the political process, getting the committeemen, elected committeemen, to control who's going on that ballot. And you see, when we have to create that environment to get justice in the courts. Right now, to get justice in the courts is an uphill battle. And you really got to get to the point in a certain way, very, very carefully, okay, because you don't want to be bold, too bold on this, but you want to signal to the judge little things and letting them know and laying out situations that he can't find a place to hang his hat, so to speak. Every time he finds a hook where he can hang the hat, because the other side will give it to him, and you got to pull that hook out of the wall and not allow that place to be. And that's by signaling the judge little things. As a matter of fact, I think the paper that I'm writing right now, which we'll have posted up this week, hopefully. Well, we will have it posted up this week, because I got to finish it in the next day or two. We will post it this week. We will discuss it next week a little bit. But that paper, I think, will be an ideal example of what you need to do to neutralize that judge, to put him in his proper place. But then there's experience and there's knowledge that needs to come along with this, because if the judge decides that he's that bold to take that step anyway, well, what do you do next? But we could talk about those things once people understand some of the things that they can do. What's the next step? Okay. But you have to be able to, you know, think free. And until you start thinking free and acting free, you're never going to be free. So it starts with thinking free and then taking that to action. Okay. And so we have to remove the protection from the judge. He's protected by this or protected by that by hanging his hat. Well, hey, look, I thought this. They said that. You didn't respond. So, hey, I had to rule that way, you know. So they always have a way to be able to try to keep maintain that status quo. We have to take that away from them. So that's one thing we're working on. Meanwhile, you know, you can learn these things on your own and try to battle it out in the courtroom as you go with these people. But you still have to. We have to win the war. We lose a lot of battles. Okay, look at George Washington. He lost most of the battles, but he won the war. That's the key. That's the only thing that really counts, is winning the war, and that's what we have to do. It doesn't matter how many battles we lose. Every battle will make us stronger, you know. So it doesn't matter how many battles we lose. It'll harden us, and it'll prepare us for the next battle, and so on. And it'll bring us to a position in a way that we can win the battle, the war, actually.
Hey, John.
Okay.
Yeah. This woman's in family court. Is that what you said?
I think so. Is that Terry, this is a family court issue, right?
Yeah, I assume that's what DCS is.
Well, you're fighting in family court is like useless. You gotta get them. You know, they're gonna violate your due process because they think they have an excuse to. And the successes that we've had in family court was by trying to move the case out of the family court. They get all upset. They don't want it out of there because they get special privileges in there. So the minute they violate your due process, when you object to that and bring it into a higher court or even the federal court, they get all upset. I mean, I think the case we were in, they just, when they realized that we were going to take it into a higher court, they smoothed everything out and they settled it. They stopped all their baloney and they came to an agreement like they could have done in the beginning.
They threw them all out of the court, as a matter of fact.
Remember?
They didn't want to hear anything anymore.
That's right. They got scared. I'm telling you, if you can get them, because they're always going to violate your due process all the time. That's what they do. And back then,
I don't think we had enough knowledge to win in the federal court if we moved it in for cause. Today, I believe we could.
But we were braver, and we had that persnicketiness of it. We acted like we knew what we were doing, and we moved it. And they didn't, you know, right away.
When you're weak, what is it? When you're weak, you make yourself look like you're strong. When you're strong, you make yourself look like you're weak.
We're like the mouse that stood up to the lion, and they back down. So there, you can get a victory if you conduct yourself right. You know how to move. Look at the points that we made were absolutely true. They were violating due process, and they were doing unconstitutional stuff. But they kind of got a green light for that in family court. They even tell you that, well, you know, this is a special case because we're dealing with people and families and kids and cases. You know, they don't necessarily honor, the rules of a normal court. You know, I mean, they do a lot of stuff in secret and they do a lot of stuff ex parte, which you're not supposed to do. But it happens all the time in family court. You know, they do all kinds of stuff ex parte. So I don't remember what paper we threw in there, John, at this point, but I do know that we were moving it out of their court. And I don't even think we said we were going in federal court. I think we just said we were bringing it to the Supreme Court, and they didn't want those judges and they didn't want that case in there. So,
well, you know, when people are dealing with this kind of a case, it's very emotional because the children involved, there's a lot of threatening going on and so on and so forth. But look at... there's only one way to deal with this, but again, you can't deal with it if you don't have the knowledge of how things work and what we are as a people, what we're all about, what our true liberties are, what our court system is made of. We have an unalienable right to a court of law, a court of justice. We have an unalienable right of that, and we have to understand what that is. And a court of justice must be run by the people, because that's where the law is. God said he put the law into the hearts of men. Okay, so everybody knows the law. It's written in the hearts of men. Everybody knows thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. Everybody knows when a wrongdoing was done and what needs to be done to fix it. Everybody knows what that solution is. You just have to find out whether the individual that's being charged with these things are innocent or not. So it's the people that make the law. It's the people that decide innocence or guilt. It's the people decide what the restitution should be. Which is the punishment in itself, the restitution. Only violent crimes should require jail sentences, you know. But the people decide. We're the law. If they try to put a civil law, a statute, or something up, and the people can just nullify it and just cast it away. But the people need to know it, okay? And we need to go after these judges that teach juries anything different. But again, you know, if I was going into family court now, I mean, for any situation, I would only go once, and I'd be there by special appearance, like I'd be in any other court that doesn't have any authority over me. And I'd give them the one ultimatum that this has to shut down. They don't have the jurisdiction. I'll challenge the jurisdiction. I'm sure right there and then, because we've seen it happen, the judge will decide, I just decided we have jurisdiction, so let's move on. And, you know, you need to understand how to deal with that. Well, you need to understand how to respond to that. and you don't need to not go back to that court no more. Now, what happens if you don't go back to that court? Well, maybe they'll come and take your children away because you're dealing with family court. I don't know. You know, I don't know what the situation
could be.
It could be a lot of things, okay? So how do you prevent that from happening? Well, you don't go back to the court because you move it to federal court for cause for violating your right of due process. Okay, and there's a list of things that you can bring into that court that the federal court has to hear and realize. And in that process, you sue them out of that federal court with a good wherefore clause, because at the end of the day, that court needs to cease and desist, okay, number one, and they need to start paying back restitution, which we interpret out into money. Okay, and that's what's going to stop these people from doing what they're doing. And they need to be gone after personally. Okay, and when you go into a court and they get these lawyers that come in that work for the town or the county or whatever the case may be, you have to object to that. These people have acted under the color of law. Why are you taking my tax money to pay for their lawyer? There's no one paying for me for a lawyer. Okay, that's part of an argument you still need to make. These people don't deserve, when they step outside of their authority, okay, they're no longer protected. You know, if you sue them, And they've maintained inside their authority and the normal processes and following the statutes and the regulations that they're under, you can't sue them and win as long as they're following those procedures. But once they step outside of that, once they take more authority than we've given them, that's when you can sue them. And so you sue them, okay? You have to make it hurt, and it's got to be in the people's pocket, okay? And that's how you can win in that case. But the question comes is, you know, do you have the proper knowledge of the system, the process, and common law in itself to be able to bring that through? Are you going to be able to put the judge into a box where he realizes he can't turn right or left and he's got to do what you want? You know, you got to make the judge wonder about you. Who is this person? And because when they do something and you respond back, and then they do something else and you respond back, and nobody's ever done that before, generally speaking, usually, okay, this judge is going to start wondering and be concerned about that and maybe thinking, I got to get this court case out of my court. You see, that's how you can beat the court now at this point. But more than that, we need to fix the problem. You need to join up with National Liberty Alliance. You need to get educated. You need to support us. You need to get active with us, working in one of the committees. You need to start organizing your counties. You need to step up and do something. That's how you're going to win. You know, united we stand, and divided we definitely will fall. Okay. I don't know how many. Let's take maybe one more or something. We'll save the rest for next week.
Okay, John, I just listened to your response to the question regarding the McCloskeys displaying their arms to repel a violent attack. They have been charged by their state. I agree this won't go anywhere. However, the McCloskeys had their personal property taken, their firearms, by armed forces. The police had a search warrant. The McCloskeys have a jury injury to be restored. Furthermore, the laws of morality and liberty have been seriously threatened. How do we restore natural law among an immoral force? We should file a lawsuit against the judge who signed the warrant. How do we do that?
Well, again, you know, the judge is bringing these people into jurisdictions unknown. If these people were here with us at National Liberty Alliance, was learning the things we're doing, and really got to involved in the education and working with these things, they'd be able to hopefully defend themselves. And a big part, look, going into court does take experience, okay? You know, the School of Hard Knocks is the best school to go to. And believe me, we went to the School of Hard Knocks. We've been in the court for over 10 years now, and believe me, we've been beat up thoroughly. But, you know, every time you lose, you win in knowledge. You get experience. You become better. You approach it in a different way. You come to an understanding. You see their strategies and so on. So that's what they have to do to win. We can't do anything for them, but if they became educated, we can potentially do some things for them. We can assist them in certain things, but they're the ones that have to push their case. you know, it is good to have people behind them. So again, if they were with us, they can ask the membership, National Liberty Alliance, in that area to come to the courthouse whenever there's a hearing going on. We do know that the governor has already, pledged a pardon should anything go crazy with this case. He's not going to allow these people to go to jail. But I definitely, if it was my situation, I'd be in court already suing this judge for violating my right of due process. There's a whole bunch of things I'm sure you could just lay out and go after this judge. You can sue
him directly. I think they're going to win. I don't think they're going to lose.
There's no doubt they're going to win. No doubt.
Look, at those people broke the gate down, broke a lock gate, went into a gated community. My goodness, if you broke a gate and went into a... Come up here by, what is that factory by me? GlaxoSmithKline. Break the lock and go in there and see how fast that their security put you on the ground with a gun in your head. In a heartbeat. You're not supposed to be in there. You know what I mean? And it was the same. That was their property, and it was a gated community, and they had no business being there. And they're making threats. I mean, you can't wave a gun around for that. I mean, and they're saying they're going to burn the house down, and they already had burned other people's houses down. They're not going to win.
They're not going to win. It's all political politics and stuff.
It's
going to roll away. And so I wouldn't, you know, again, if there's anything we could do for them, we would do it, but they'd have to come to see us to do something, and they'd have to get themselves educated, and they'd have to do the work in the courts. But I definitely, if I was them, I'd be suing.
They probably won't, because they're both lawyers, so they're their own worst enemy.
Well, there you go. That is a problem, isn't it?
I don't know.
Okay. I guess we'll end questions, because we're running long on this. Is Brent in yet?
No, he's not here.
Okay.
So
all right.
He's coming tonight.
So we'll move over to Gerard. Keep an eye on for Brent. If Brent comes in, if it's not too late, Gerard, you can give him some time on the mic, huh? Okay. Yeah, Gerard, you got the board? Anybody that's got any questions or comments, star 6 and 1. Star 6 to get into the queue and 1. Gerard?
Yeah, I just unmuted myself. I hate this screen. It disappears on me.
Okay, you're going to take the mic and the board?
Yeah.
Hold on. What?
Brent says he's calling in now. I haven't seen him show up yet, but he says he's calling in.
All right, so we'll just give him a minute and see.
All right, let me see. Click on duration. I'll let you know if I see him come in. You know, if you click on the duration, you'll see the last person that came in. And building up, and maybe you'll find them quicker that way. So, all right. Well, with that, let me pass things. Let's take one more question, and we'll give it to Brent, and then Brent, then over to, we'll give it to Gerard and Brent. But let's take another question. We'll give it a few more minutes, because okay. I did have a question for Brent I wanted to ask him before we moved forward. But go ahead.
Certainly. I named the prosecutor and judge in my federal lawsuit the failure of them to respond in 30 days. Is their admission of guilt. Can we send an indictment to the federal marshals to have them arrested and stand trial?
Well, again, you know, not knowing how the process works and the next step to take, you know, you're your own enemy. Look at you do an affidavit of default, you take it down to the clerk and you file it, and then you execute the wherefore clause, you go over to the judge to get it executed. He has a duty to sign it. He can't not sign it once you have that affidavit of default. It's truth, it's fact. You better not lie in it. And then once the judge puts that signature on it, any judge can do that, and it's just a procedure. And then you take it down to the sheriff for collection. Okay, but if people don't understand that, how to collect and exercise the win in the court from a default, well, then, of course, that's a problem. Well, what are you going to do? So they have to, again, we have a problem because we don't understand these things, and we should understand these things, okay? You know, one of the things we're going to endeavor to do is to write textbooks for schools and get them into the schools. We need to train our children on the way that they should walk and the duty they have at because of the privileges and the blessings of liberty that they have, the heritage that they are born under. They need to understand that and they need to step up and take power and authority and do the right thing and give back to society, okay? And when I say give back, look at every person needs to participate with the militia unless they're physically unable, okay? Every person should become a committee man at least once in their life. It's a 2-year commitment. It's only 40 hours a year, roughly speaking. It's not no big deal. But it's a very rewarding job. You get to interview the people. The whole thing is about interviewing people to put them on the ballot. That's the really the whole thing. And then walking the papers to get them onto that ballot, get those signatures, enough signatures to put them onto the ballot. That's what it's about. It's a very exciting position. It's a powerful position. It's a duty that every person, every American should do at least once in their lifetime. And more if they want, but at least once. Okay, they need to respond to the jury. We need to take control of our juries, the administrations of our juries, and properly orientate the jury and prepare them, and people need to become educated. But we need to also bring a proper education into our schools. You know, I talk to some kids here or there, you know, and they don't know the difference between the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. They're confused. A lot of them didn't even really know who Benjamin Franklin is. They kind of know the name, but they don't know what he did or who he is. Jefferson, they don't know that he is the guy that created this whole thing. Our children aren't taught those things. They're not taught about liberty. They're not taught the Constitution. You get these children go to school out of ignorance, maybe because their parents give them an ignorant thing, or maybe they, whatever it is, and they refuse to do the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, they don't understand the Pledge of Allegiance, okay? You know, you're pledging allegiance to the flag for the republic for which it stands, one nation under God. That's who we are as a people of law. Don't we all want that? If our children understood that and understood their duties as a people, you know, we should teach our children how to handle a weapon in school. Every child should know how to handle a rifle and a handgun. Every child. Every child should be taught at the appropriate age, of course. We'll have to figure that out.
Well, that used to be taught in an elementary school. They used to have rifles.
Right. Well, that's what they have to do now. We have to teach our children even how to drive in school. They should learn how to drive a vehicle in school. Okay. That'll settle a lot of problems. Okay. But we need to really introduce them. From grade 1 all the way to grade 12, we need to introduce our children to our founding fathers. They need to intimately know who they are, what they've done, the successes they had in their life, the struggles they had in their life, and the successes, you know, the victories. They need to know, and it's our duty to do that.
So. Brent's in the queue.
Okay. All right, unmute Brent and. We'll move over to Brent in a minute. Brent, let me know when you can talk.
Oh, I can talk, I think.
How you doing, Brent? I got a question for you. I got a question for you. You know how a big ploy with the lawyers is to try to not answer an action, you know, when you send a paper and you put it out. And,
right.
You know, they'll try to move you with Rule 12, maybe, you know, failing to state, I'm not sure exactly how that goes, but basically state a case, a cause of action or whatever. Okay, mm-hmm. Now if they move it into federal court, okay, because I got a case right now, it's in state court. They responded on the very last day, okay, mm-hmm. And they sent it out on the 30th day they put it in the mail. Okay, which makes it good for them. I got it a day or two later. And, okay, so they made the time. But they filed an appearance, okay, and then they filed a paper to move the court. Now, in order for them to do that, don't they have to get what's it called?
Leave of court.
Leave of the court first. And if they don't do that, and they go past the 30 days and they defaulted, is that the case, or they don't need that? They could
They didn't actually answer the case. They just made a motion to move it into federal court, right?
Right, that's, but they didn't was, they didn't talk to a judge. They didn't get leave of court.
Their answer was that they were going to move it to federal court. There's no RJI, so there's no judge involved.
Right.
And they waited until the last day. So I feel like they just waited too long. and they went to the default date, and they just threw that in there as a smoke screen to say, well, we answered.
Well, I think that's the case, too, but I don't know how the procedures actually go in the court. Maybe, Brent, you could tell us how that works, if you can help us.
Removal is not something you move for. You don't move for removal. You just remove. Now, there's a historic reason for that, whether it's right or wrong. I don't know, but it comes from the old country in England when men used to remove cases from the Roman ecclesiastic courts, which were the church courts, to the king's courts, and they would just remove them. It's not removal. That's the way it started. We've been doing it that way ever since, and in our tradition here, we have the state courts and the federal courts, and if somebody in one of the parties in the state court action believes that it's a federal question that arises, the key words are rising under the Constitution, then they say, well, the federal courts have jurisdiction, and you remove it to the federal court. Now, what happens after that is the federal court then must decide whether they do have jurisdiction. We had talked before about who has the responsibility to decide jurisdiction, and somebody said, well, the courts don't have, or the federal judges don't have that duty. It's not their responsibility to do that. Well, but no, it is. In the first instance, it is the responsibility. In other words, it's an appealable decision, but they have to decide. Nobody else can decide. And so every court is, in the first instance, responsible to decide whether or not it has jurisdiction. So you remove it to federal court, and you fight it out there. You don't fight it out at the lower court. You say, well, that doesn't sound right. That's the way it is in our common law tradition. It's been that way for centuries. So you remove it to the federal court. I've been in cases where other people have removed cases to the federal court. We fought it out, and the federal court said no, and they sent it back to the state court. I've been in other cases where I removed it to the federal court, and the federal court said, yes, I do have jurisdiction, or this court has jurisdiction, this federal court, and we kept it there. But it's not a motion. You don't request removal. You remove.
Right. Let me give you another piece on this, and then to try to get to the real question. Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It's a notice of removal. Okay. It's only a couple pages. It's very short and sweet. It was done on the 30th day. It was mailed on the 30th day. So they never answered. So I guess they don't have to answer until the federal court makes a decision. And let's say they make the decision, okay, the case belongs here. How much time do they get? They shouldn't get another 30 days to answer, although that's what I presume they're going to try to do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they'll get it. Yeah. The requirement isn't that you have to answer the complaint. The requirement is that you have to answer or otherwise respond. I think that's the way it's almost always worded in the states and the federal courts. Answer or otherwise respond. Of course, the response is going to be often a jurisdiction response. Now, when they remove it to federal court, they're claiming you're in the wrong jurisdiction, so that they haven't answered your complaint, but they have meaningfully responded. And so you fight it out on the basis of jurisdiction. Now, when they file a 12B6, you talked about Rule 12, 12B6, that's one of the first things people learn in law school is Rule 12B6, because that's a challenge of jurisdiction. They say the court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear this case because the complaint does not state a complaint upon which relief can be granted. We can't even, the court, it's not even possible, that's a 12B6 motion, it says that the court is not even going to be able to provide any relief at all for the way this complaint is written.
Mm-hmm.
You have failed, let me quote it, you have failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, I think is the way the 12B6 reads. Yeah.
That's it.
So they'll claim that you have failed to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. Well, that can come in many forms, and you have to think about what your complaint is. Say, can the court grant relief on this complaint? And if they can, then you argue, no, the court can grant relief on this complaint, and here's why, and here's the cases that support what we're doing. Never forget, some people say case law is not common law, but case law is common law in this sense. Case law, we call it law. It's not law, it's just the case opinions, but they call it that. It's in this sense, the courts are a separate and equal branch of government to the executive and to the legislative. Therefore, they go by their own rules. If the courts above have said that this, that, or the t'other, then the courts below are bound by our common law tradition to follow the courts, not the legislature and not the executive branch, because we have a common law government, separate and equal branches of government. So the courts are a branch unto themselves. They don't depend, just like the branches that grow out of a tree, the branches don't depend upon any other branch on the tree, they depend on the trunk. And the trunk of the tree is the Constitution of the United States, and the Constitution of the United States is rooted deep in the common law. So the branches are independent, and the judicial branch depends upon itself for what it's going to do. It does not depend upon the executive branch unless until it wants to. If it wants to agree with the executive branch, it will. If it doesn't want to, it won't. And the same thing is true of the executive branch when it comes to the judicial branch. And the same thing is true of the legislative branch when it comes to the other two branches. If they don't want to agree, they don't have to agree. But if they want to agree, they can. But in every case, they do what they think is best. And the judicial branch depends upon the cases that were ruled upon on like facts and previous decision. And we call that stare decisis. And that's why they follow the previously decided cases on like facts. Well, that's a lot of talk. I hope there was something there you could grab.
Yeah, and that's how they see what common law. That's how they look at common law. It's really a lot of decisions of previous cases.
But that's only a small part of common law. Common law is no man has a right to do wrong, and that means that every person and every branch of government has to make their own decision about what right is wrong, right and wrong is, and they're not allowed to depend. And none of us are allowed to depend upon any other person to substitute their brains and their opinions for ours. That's the strength of our country, and that goes for every person, every juror, every member of every branch of government. Some people under the impression today that the Supreme Court of the United States is the final rule on things. It never has been, and it never will be, and not as long as we're a common law country. And that's the way our Constitution is written. The Constitution doesn't say that, but it says, it's everything about it says that it's the branches of government are independent. I mean, if you're ordered to do something by government orders you to do something that's unlawful, you have a responsibility to disobey regardless of the consequences. Just like if government commands you to do something that's against the laws of God, you're required to follow God, not the laws of men, regardless right. of how ugly the consequences may be. And there have been plenty of men that have followed that. But back to this thing about 12b-6, 12b-6 is a jurisdictional challenge, a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. If relief can't be granted, then the court has no jurisdiction to take the case.
Well, I don't disagree with their removal. And I figured I'd end up there anyway. I started off in the state court for strategy reasons, really. And but you've answered my question. The thing is that they have to do something. And what they did is they gave a notice of removal, and that's what they did. And that kind of freezes everything up until we now get to some kind of a decision on which jurisdiction we belong in. But of course, they're going to try to move that case to be dismissed once they get into the federal court. I've been there numerous times, and I know they're game in there now, and
why?
Hopefully we'll be able to defend against it.
Why do you think they didn't use 12b-6 to begin with in the state court? That's like they've done numerous times before. Why didn't they go?
Well, in a sense, in some of their wording, they did. Okay, I think they did anyway. You know, again, I'm still digesting this. I got this on Saturday, but I really didn't just sit down and think about it until Sunday. And I thought about it a lot last night and today. And I've been writing a paper, and I'm kind of digesting all this stuff. It's only 3 pages. But, you know, as you read through these lines, point by point, a little thing here and a little thing there, you know, it just expounds and you start to realize, that's where they're going with this or that's where they're going with that. So I already see their strategies, you know.
Maybe because there was no RJI file, they couldn't ask a judge anything. So,
well, that's what my thinking was.
It was too late for them to, otherwise they would have went with Rule 12b-6, but they were too late.
Well, they could have went with that anyway in the paperwork. They didn't refer to it. But again, you know, I'm still dissecting it.
Are you surprised that they didn't go with Rule 12? They like it so much. We've seen it so many times, and I'm just.
Well, you know, I haven't seen it yet. When we went up against the IRS, and I took them to state court here, and then they pulled it over into the federal court there. They also didn't go. They tried to go for that, but they didn't go for that when they pulled it out of the court. And then when they got stuck over there. They really got stuck. When we went down to that one hearing, they really got stuck, and they didn't know which way to go. And we were kind of unsure on what it was that we hit on that upset them so much. But I think we know now.
Right.
But in any event, every time that has happened, it's happened a few times to me, they haven't brought up the Rule 12 until you get into the federal court, you know? And
right.
They've done it to me already. On latter cases in the IRS, and but with the Rule 12 thing. But on that one case, they never moved for that. I don't know. They just never moved for that. All right. Anyway, we're going to move on. All right. I'm going to introduce Brent. He's going to take the mic. You're going to take the board, right, Gerard?
Yeah, when he's done, yeah.
Okay, Brent. Unmute Brent if you can.
I think he is unmuted.
Okay, we got... No, right now I see him unmuted. Just have to hit his mic and unmute him.
Oh, okay.
Brent Allen Winters is the author of a few books, particularly the one we're interested mostly in, is The Excellence of the Common Law, Brent Allen Winters. His website is commonlawyer.com. And, Brent, you got the mic.
I can't unmute it.
Let me see if I could do it.
It's not working, and I don't want to lose.
Huh.
He's right up there next to that red end session. You make a mistake, you'll knock everybody off.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to right now. Hang on a minute. Let's see. That's not going to work.
Well, who muted him?
Well, let's get him in the...
He's got the light color on his own phone, so I think he muted himself. Brent, will you try star 6?
Yeah, try star 6, Brent. Okay, let me see if I could find him in the regular list of people.
Yeah, he's here. I see him.
Well, no, do you see him in the regular list?
Yeah.
Well, then click his mic there in the regular list.
All right, it's not...
The caller list.
It's not doing anything for me, though. It's kind of... It's weird. It's not blue, but it's like off color.
Well, let's try this. If I hit him out...
Wait a minute. I just knocked him out of the queue. Let me try it now. Maybe I can do it now. Hang on, Brent. Now he should be able to unmute
What himself. Page is he on? Oh,
he's
I
on the
see
first
him.
Page.
Okay. Yeah, he's kind of lighted out. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, it's like he's got a light blue. And before he had the little queue thing, like he was in the queue, but now he's getting out of the
queue. All right, Brent, if you can't unmute yourself with a star 6, why don't you leave the call and come back in? If you can't get unmuted with a star 6.
And it looks like...
Terry, why don't you connect with Brent this week or get someone else if necessary and show him how to come in as a host in the room so he can, you know, mute and unmute himself.
You know, look at Heather Lee jumped up into queue, but she's muted, and I don't know.
Yeah, I muted her. I muted
her. Oh, did you?
Well, because it opened the mic. Let me see. I should be able to unmute her. No,
okay,
I unmuted her. Let me mute her again now back. Okay. So when Brent's finished, just click her mic to unmute, and you have to wait a few seconds after you click. It takes a while for it to digest.
Okay. So she's ready to go. I just got to unmute her. Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Brent's in now, I think. So let me unmute him. Let's try that now. Okay, you're unmuted, Brent.
I'm here.
Okay, you got the mic, Brent. I gave the intro, and Gerard, you have the board.
Okay.
Before we do this, are there any announcements that's necessary, Terry? Or
none that I have.
Okay. All right. The only announcement, again, is we're going to be going to court soon here in the Southern District. We mentioned this a little earlier. It's a federal court district in White Plains, the case against YouTube. And when that date comes up, we're going to get it out to everybody. And we'd like anybody that can come to that case and sit in and do an affidavit would really be appreciated. This is a very important case for National Liberty Alliance because it could fund us in ways that we never could believe. But, Rick, you got the mic.
Thank you. And thank you so much for allowing me a little time to say a few things. My opinions are my own. May or may not agree with other members of the principles of National Liberty Alliance, but it's important to me that folks that aren't lawyers learn what they can about our legal tradition and our law and get in and try to do it. Lawyers don't know what they're doing until they go to court. Let me repeat that one. Lawyers do not know what they're doing until they go to court and they go through a tough learning curve to learn how to get in the courts and fight. It's a brutal system. It's adversarial. Lawyers don't give each other a break in court, and they're not going to give non-lawyers a break either. But non-lawyers can learn how to do it just like lawyers learn it. How you do it? Well, you get in there and start slugging. That's how you do it. That's how lawyers learn. I can't tell you the humiliation I've suffered because I didn't know what I was doing. And it takes, there's a lot of things I still don't know what I'm doing. I don't even want to talk about them. It makes me mad to think about it, how some of the things I've done and tried to do and wasting my time. But over the centuries, the processes of our common law in the courts have developed, and they're fixed. And once you get in and you begin to learn them, and it takes a lot of time, and it takes humiliation to do it. And it's the baptism of fire. You can't learn it in law school. Why? Because our common law, unlike the law of the city, is not a matter of cookbooking. It's a matter of, and I say this softly, but I have to say it in fact, it's the way it is. It's a matter of chivalry. It's the old rules of chivalry. You learn them. They're not written down. And you get a feel for them after a while, and then you begin to work with them. It takes a while. You're trying to get past, for example, 12b-6. 12b-6 is a tough rule. 12b-6 doesn't admit of any exceptions, and it's a challenge to jurisdiction. Jurisdiction. What is jurisdiction? Jurisdiction is the, listen to this one, jurisdiction is the right to act respecting a given matter. The right to act respecting a given matter. And if the court doesn't have jurisdiction, they don't have the right to act respecting the matter before the court, and they'll turn it down. Now, the courts of our states, for instance, in this case, the state of New York, where they're filing this case, the courts of all of our states, every one of them, are courts of relatively unlimited jurisdiction. Unlimited. The state courts of the several states of the United States have jurisdiction to hear any problem that comes up, state or federal, arising under the Constitution, not arising under the Constitution, but under the Constitution of the state, relatively unlimited as a practical matter. The federal courts, by distinction, are extremely limited of their jurisdiction. And the key phrase, mentioned a while ago, the key phrase of that dictates the jurisdiction of the federal court, if any case comes before the federal courts, any of the federal courts, it has to be a matter that arises under, those are the operative words, arises under the Constitution of the United States. That's it. Now, some people stretch the definition and say, arises under the Constitution of the United States and the laws of the United States. Well, why do they say that? Well, all the laws of the United States are supposed to be under the Constitution. But there are some laws, no, I'll take that back. There are a lot of laws that do not arise under the Constitution. In other words, the Congress passes laws and the President signs laws into law that are not within the jurisdiction of the Constitution of the United States. Therefore, the federal courts say laws that purport to be under the Constitution, you can bring those into our court. Maybe we want to declare them unconstitutional. But as a matter of law, if it doesn't arise under the Constitution somehow, the courts, the federal courts, the federal district courts, the Supreme Court of the United States has no jurisdiction at all to hear the case. Now, often, federal courts will do whatever they can to get rid of to get rid of a case because that's their policy, because their courts have limited jurisdiction. Again, remember, their jurisdiction is limited to matters arising under the Constitution of the United States. So it is the propensity of federal courts to try to get rid of cases. It's the propensity of state courts to keep cases because their jurisdiction, to repeat, is unlimited. That is why Rule 12b-6 is such a blasted big deal. Here we are saying 12b-6. Gerard said 12b-6. John said Rule 12b, or 12. He meant 12b-6. He was referring to the same rule. Here we are talking about it, and all of a sudden we all agree and realize that it's a big deal. Why is it a big deal? Because Rule 12b-6, when you file a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6, what you're saying is, this court has no jurisdiction to hear this case. Jurisdiction is the holy of holies of our common law tradition. When I say it's the holy of holies, it might be good to drop a footnote and say what that means. That's a phrase, of course, out of the Bible, out of the Old Testament, and there was the court around the temple of the Israelites, and only certain people were allowed in there. Then there was the court within the temple, or the room within the temple, and only certain other people, a smaller subset of Israelites, were allowed in there. And then there was the Holy of Holies. Well, there was only one man allowed in there once a year. And on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when he went in and made symbolic a symbol of atonement for man's law-breaking. And he was the only fellow ever allowed in there. Now, the tradition is they put a bell on his ankle, and when they heard that bell stop tingling, they knew he'd done something wrong, and God had struck him dead. And they also tied a rope to his ankle so that if God did strike him dead and they heard the tinkling stop, then they could drag him out of there without having to go in there themselves, which makes good sense when you consider that it's the death penalty without exception if you do something wrong. So the Holy of Holies is a special place where a man in the person of the high priest would meet God by symbol anyway, once a year. Of course, the reality is that man does meet God in a holy place and at the person, the high priest of Melchizedek, which is Jesus Christ himself, and that's the only place that man can meet God. There is no other place, none at all. That's the message. But the Holy of Holies is that place of special jurisdiction, and jurisdiction is the Holy of Holies. That, by the way, that's a superlative in the Hebrew tongue. That's not a comparative. Holy of Holies is the way they would say, not to be compared with anything else, but to be beyond comparison. Well, that's the way jurisdiction is. If there's a murder case, for instance, a murder case, and a man is tried according to due process, and the jury convicts him, and he appeals all the way to the Supreme Court of the state, and then the Supreme Court of the United States, and they all come back and say, no, due process was followed, he's convicted, and he's got to suffer the penalty. And then later on he comes back and he says, now, wait a minute, 20 years later, wait a minute, the court that tried me originally didn't have jurisdiction. Why? By the way, I've seen this happen. I was involved in a case where this really happened. He came back later and he said, state court can't try me for this crime, even though I was convicted and we appealed, because the state court didn't have jurisdiction. Why not? Because I say that this murder, it was a murder case, I say that this murder of which you convicted me, or say you convicted me, it happened within the territorial boundaries of an Indian reservation. An Indian reservation in Arizona. And the state court has no jurisdiction of anything that happens on an Indian reservation. And they said, okay. And then they said, wait a minute, but what tribe do you belong to? Well, I belong to so-and-so tribe. We've been around since the beginning. Well, they said, but we're looking here, and we don't see that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has recognized you. Well, they did used to, but they don't no longer recognize you as a separate tribe. And then the fight began over whether they had in personam jurisdiction over this man who was an Indian, who they accused of committing a murder. And they said it happened within the territorial jurisdiction of the state, but it didn't. He said it happened right after they drove the pickup truck across the line of the Indian reservation. And on the fight goes. It's important. No, it's not a waste of time, because that's a matter of jurisdiction. What is jurisdiction? Remember what jurisdiction is: the right to act respecting a given matter. And state courts have no right to act on federal land. Federal land. Those are federal enclaves. We talked about this the other day. We're talking about sheriffs. Sheriffs. Do sheriffs have the authority to go into a federal courthouse and do anything? And the answer is no, they don't. But on the other hand, does a federal marshal have the authority to go into the county, the territorial boundaries of the county of a sheriff in some state, and do whatever he wants without putting the sheriff on notice and getting his permission? Again, the answer is no. These are separate territorial jurisdictions, sovereignties. The general government in Washington, D.C. is a separate sovereignty. The state governments of the several states are separate sovereignties. The general government, the agents of the general government in Washington, D.C. cannot commandeer sheriffs. How do I know? Well, that's the whole point of the case Prince versus United States, of which Sheriff Mack was involved. Sheriff Mack, the other sheriff, was from Montana. Mack was from New Mexico. They were both sheriffs. They both combined the case. They combined the cases. The federal government said they had jurisdiction to tell them what to do to run background checks on people that were purchasing firearms. Justice Scalia wrote the opinion. He said, no, those are separate jurisdictions. The federal government cannot commandeer, that was the word he used, commandeer employees of state government. Why? Because they don't have the right to act that way. That's what jurisdiction is. Jurisdiction is the right to act respecting a given matter, the right to exercise authority respecting a given matter. That's the difference between the federal government in Washington, D.C. and the state government. There's not another country in the world like ours. Not another one. Separate jurisdictions. I was talking to a fellow the other day. Man, it's been a couple months ago. Guy was a goofball. Made me mad. Got to talking to him at a restaurant. I said, what do you do? He had a little baby and a wife. Got to talking to him and his wife, and they had this cute little baby, and I like babies. Little boy. I saw a little boy tonight at the restaurant. There was the waiter there. I was there. The guy sitting at the table next to me was there with three young boys and his wife. And us boys got to talking, us men. And the waiter had a busted wrist. I said, what happened? He got to telling me. I told him about how I got thrown from a horse one time and boogered my wrist up real bad, landed on both hands. And then the other guy started telling the story about how he got hurt, and this 12-year-old kid stood up and he said, I got you all beat. And he lifted up his shirt so I could see his belly, and he had a scar that ran from his sternum way on down and went two ways. And I said, where'd you get that? He said, I just got a liver transplant. All these men bragging about their scars and their injury. Get to laughing. Got to talking about that. And got to talking about jurisdiction. We got to talking about the mask that they were making the waiter wear. And he took it off, said, I'm sick of this thing. I can't breathe anymore. I said, what are you wearing it for? He said, well, they'll won't let me work here. Well, does the government have jurisdiction to command you? Or does the corporation, he worked for a corporation, it was a chain restaurant, do they have jurisdiction to tell you to do that? Well, that's pretty shaky. I says, does the government have jurisdiction? Does the governor have jurisdiction, the right to act, to tell you to wear a mask and to enforce that? And the answer is no. Not just no, but 1,000 times no. That's so contrary to every sensibility we have as Americans, that a governor has the jurisdiction to pass legislation by himself without going through the inconvenient process of asking the legislature to pass a bill so he can sign it. He has no jurisdiction to do that. This should be disobeyed without question, with aggressiveness at every point, because it's fundamental to our freedoms. Jurisdiction is the holy of holies. It is the thing that there's no statute of limitation that can end it. Remember I'd said, 20 years later, if you come back and say in any case the court didn't have jurisdiction, well, that jury verdict is null and void if you can prove it to the court. That's how important jurisdiction is. These concepts, jurisdiction, due process, are inextricably bound together, mutually supportive, undergirding each other, and fundamental to all of our common law tradition. Authority. What is authority? It is the right to act. What is jurisdiction? That stresses a different aspect of authority. Jurisdiction is the right to act respecting a given matter. Authority is the right to act. Jurisdiction is the right to act respecting a given matter. That stresses a different aspect of the same idea. These are fundamental. Well, that's enough talk for tonight. Again, appreciate the opportunity to say a few words. I do want to drop a blurb here and say that we've started a due process class on Saturdays. It meets from 8 to 10 Saturday mornings. Go to the website, commonlawyer.com, and go to the events button at the top of the page, and you can see there how to register, how to participate, and you can participate. Due process is not included in our common law. Due process is our common law. The words law of the land mean due process, because our common law is not result-oriented, it is process-oriented. Our common law is a way. It is a course of process. And the course of process is different in every case, depending upon what fair play demands. That's why we say we don't know our common law until the need arises, until there is an adversarial conflict. The courts don't even have jurisdiction, says our Constitution of the United States, over a case that is not adversarial. What does that mean? That means there must be a bloody plaintiff. Bloody plaintiff? Yeah, that's what lawyers say. That means there must be a plaintiff that has had real, seeable damage. His body is busted up. He's lost money. He's lost property. And he's complaining. Well, that constitutes, I'm quoting our Constitution, a real case and controversy. A real controversy, not a hypothetical question. Well, what would happen in this case, or what would happen in that case? Why? Because if we don't have two parties fighting, our common law, our view of the law, our due process says if two parties aren't fighting and don't stand to lose life, liberty, property, or a combination thereof, if they don't stand to lose that, they're not going to be sharpened to the contest enough to make a real fight, and the truth will never be uncovered. We believe that the truth is buried under, as Paul the Apostle says, Romans 1, the truth is buried under an overburden of unrighteousness. And the only way to get it out is to start a fight. That's what we believe. That's why we have trials in our common law countries. They don't have trials in other countries. They just have poor people before the court with a couple of civilians, civil law lawyers, law of the city lawyers, deciding what they're going to do with the poor parties before the court. And it's result-oriented. We've just got to do what the government says. We don't do that in America. But again, it comes back to jurisdiction. That's enough talk Saturday mornings, and we're teaching a class. Of course, we'd like people to come. Back to you, Gerard. And Gerard is trying to find his unmute button, like I was trying to find mine. If I'm still here. Yeah, I'm still here.
The time on that, you said, was 9 to 11?
Eight to ten Pacific, which would be nine to 11 Rocky Mountain, 10 to 12 Central, and 11 to 1 Eastern, if I got it right, extrapolating from Pacific.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Okay, are you done, or I was...
Yeah, I'm taking a breather. Go ahead.
I kind of started daydreaming here when you were talking about stuff you were saying. No, we're good. I mean, if we're ready for questions, I'll move on. If you were...
Yeah, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll pull up... it looks like Heather Lee's been waiting there. Let me open her mic and see what she's got here.
Okay, good evening. This is what I have. First of all, I just... and make it known that I have divinely, apparently, am in possession of 1 through 4 volumes of the writings of Thomas Jefferson, 1830.
Wow.
And it's the second edition. And it's all the letters and correspondence and memoirs and miscellaneous of Thomas Jefferson himself. And so I just thought I'd let John know in case some of these might be pertinent for cases now. How
yeah,
about
good
that?
Reference. Good re- you auctioning them off or what? No, I'm kidding.
No, I had to pay dearly for these.
Yeah, they fell
into my possession through a quiet neighborhood sale. He was the naval man. He was quite high, and he had these in his home. And I think that they're just a divine gift, is what they are. But I also realize that they're the possibility of the usage of them to further our cases.
Right.
I just throw that out. Okay,
right.
And there is a way to get them to John if he so desires to read them.
Very
okay, my comment tonight, it's not a comment, it's a case. My case with in the joinder of jurisdictions unknown that they that property was taken from me, 280 acres in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I have just received, after all this time, going through taking it out of their jurisdiction, taking it for jurisdiction reasons, taking it right out of their court with an amicus, also moving it into federal court, and now I have a decision and order on it, which I'm hopefully waiting for John to file. And in that, they have decided that they're going to send me a notice to appear on August 12th, and for a status conference.
Oh, here we go.
What a hoot. What a hoot. Yes, okay. Well, it's not even in your court. And then they threaten me, important, to bring this notice to you. No case may be adjourned except by the authority of the judge for good cause shown. Really? Failure of the defendant to appear in a civil case may cause a default judgment to be entered. Really? So anyway, yeah, they're trying to move me in jurisdictions unknown. And I've listened this evening as John expounded on some of the prior questions. And I noted to put the judge on notice. He was talking about the case that we have with YouTube and such before the court, and he was going to put the judge in a precarious position. Well, I would like to know what that is, because I'd like to put this one in a precarious position. And this one is already there because I've already brought him into default. I already went through the procedure and brought him right into default before I even knew about National Liberty Alliance. So he's already kicked at me.
Right.
And then I sent an amicus, to which he had the unmitigated gall to deny the amicus. Really?
Oh, really?
So then we resent on the basis that I had joined all the concerned cases of them selling it to these people and this person and this, all the entities involved, I just threw it back into that same case number. He says, well, you can't just do that. You can't just do that. So I sent him all individual amicuses after that. So the doubly amicus. So anyway, so he's saying sue the judge for violating rights of due process, and of course I'm taking Brent's due process course and the right to act respecting a certain matter, which is the jurisdiction. So anyway, I'm just wondering at this point in time, because it is an NLA case, it is in the process of decision and order already, and this dude, this pompous donkey judge, is trying to throw it back into jurisdictions unknown. Okay, what's the procedure here?
I don't know. You were. I really don't. I'm confused because you moved it into federal court already, right?
Right. But he's threatening that he's going to already give these thieves, okay, in his pirate court, he's going to hand over a default judgment to them for a status conference if I don't appear.
They always say that. In other words, if you have to appear or they're going to go ahead and rule on the case, that's in any case they'll say that. But look, this is the same case that where you had filed a patent on the land that I'm working with Robert with.
I'm working with Robert with that, but right. I want to know, too, what should I proceed with the case that they already know. This judge already has those amicus. They have already been notified. It's been moved right out of his stinking court, out of Marquette, and into New York. He knows that, into federal court. Mm-hmm. But he's still coming at me. He's still trying to reign.
And this is the federal court that you're in.
The case is in federal court through in LA, but this is the local
court trying to suck you back in.
Right. This is another date. Yeah. That's what they're doing. He's ignoring it. In other words,
he really should have responded to us in this case. That's what we got to discuss this with John, because he's not supposed to just respond to you. We filed an amicus. What did he say? He's throwing those amicuses out? Is that what he said?
Oh, yeah, he denied the amicus.
Oh, so he's in default. He's in default of our amicus, is what you're saying.
Yeah. He denied it.
Yeah, he needs to. Well, you see, the next move would really be our move to give him a what do you call it? Ugh, I'm having a senior moment here.
A suit?
Yeah, well,
he's
out. Yeah, an indictment, exactly, because he's in bad behavior here.
Yes, well, I have to get John to file my DNO, and I have to wait 30 days now. My DNO was done before, but for some reason it's being held up. And I need that filed because I need to go into an indictment for this dude.
Yeah, that's really where you're at with him. I mean, he obviously doesn't care. I mean,
he has a vendetta against me because I've used common law against him. I've used corporate law, his own law, against him. And I proved him, and I really...
You gotta remove him from the case elsewhere. Besides an indictment, there's got to be something you can file to remove him because he's doing a vindictive thing here, or you know what I mean? He's got a conflict of interest. There's a couple of different things that he's doing that you could bring up. I would try to get him removed off the case if you could. I don't know. You know, look at you're in federal court with us, but he basically denied even answering that, right? Or he didn't acknowledge.
Right. No, he's not even acknowledging it.
Right. Well,
he's not
acknowledging
it, and this is vindictive. What is it called? Vindictive.
Prosecution, persecution. I don't know.
Yeah, prosecution.
It should be filed in federal court against him. You know what I mean? Because he's weaponized the court against you, and he's in the lower court. I mean, it should go to the federal court. I don't know.
Well, it said right here. Let's see. To sue, I think Brent said, sue the judge.
Exactly, because look at what he's doing. because he's
violating
bad.
Rights of due process.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but also, Gerard, the thing is that you're right. He's sending it to me, ignoring NLA.
Right.
So it is like he's bypassing the whole kit and caboodle. And the thing is that he has to be answerable to that joinder.
And he's already under default, right? He's already in default of that, right?
Yes, because he denied the amicus.
Right, and so in other words, we got a decision in order that he hasn't received yet. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because it's been done, but I guess it's not filed yet. I don't know because John is busy or...
That's the first thing we got to do is get that decision in order filed. But in the meantime, I think you need to sue him to stop him. I think he needs to be removed. However you got to do that.
I think so, too. I don't think
you can wait just for our amicus because, look, an amicus is a friend of the court, and they think, the way the judge thinks, he can take it in consideration if he wants to. Of course, we do it in the perspective of the grand jury, which they're not used to that. They don't know what that means, or they don't want to know what that means anyway.
No, he doesn't want to know.
Right, exactly. So you really got
to
go after him.
Power.
More directly. I mean, he's going to hide behind, who is this and what is this? We've never seen this before, so he feels comfortable ignoring it at this point, right?
Yeah, he's all comfy and way up there in the north, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
He's got his own little kingdom.
Right. So.
And so, Okay.
I would go after him, and I would talk to Brent about that because he's more procedurally knowledgeable than I am with this. And it doesn't mean you won't get beat up for going in there, but you don't know until you try. You know what I mean? It's a battle. So now he threw a punch, and now you got to 1-2 him back. You know.
Well, I'm pretty tenacious, so.
No, I know. And then you got other things going on too that we need to discuss as far as what they already have in their hands. They're in a mess in your case, and I don't even think they realize what a mess they're in yet. You know?
Oh, I think that the guys that bought the property, they were warned by the treasurer that there were problems already because I had already filed things that were way beyond them.
Right.
Whether they be in commercial or not, they were legal documents that they couldn't, get around. And they were waiting to see if I knew how to administer them. Well,
right.
I didn't have the tools to be able to really know the meets and bounds of those. But now
right.
I'm in common law and I have the Constitution in
right.
written here.
Right. And I got to talk to Rob. I didn't get a chance to talk to Robert about that document you sent me, and I will do that. I had a crazy week this week, but
yeah.
I will get to him, and that's a
second move against this court.
Right.
That's a second move. Because that's been filed for years.
Yeah, like I said, they got a lot of problems. You know what I mean? That they're not even considering. They're not looking at the big picture yet, but it's going to come clear.
And on top of that, there was a $2 million lien through my trust against
which is
this property.
Interesting, yeah.
And they violated that, too.
So I'll probably talk to Robert tomorrow. But I just want to let you know, I did get that, and I will confer with him on that. So I'm going to let you go, and we'll get back to you. We'll finish this off this site anyway, okay?
Okay, good.
Thank you, Heather. Yeah, you too. Okay. Well, this thing works backwards, my goodness. Okay, we got Dan from Carolinas on. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Greetings, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. As it turns out, I've just received some legal documents concerning, and I won't quote my brother's appellation over the airwaves here, but it's coming from him and his new wife, who has total, as I've reported before, total power of attorney over him. He is supposed to not be able to be competent. However, there is some documents that have just come from Wilmington, North Carolina. It's alluding to the United States Bankruptcy Court, Eastern District of North Carolina, Wilmington Division. And I've got a case number, which I certainly will not divulge, but the point is, there's an attorney over in Wilmington that has submitted in a second letter, besides the jurisdiction concerning the United States Bankruptcy Court. And this attorney, of course, is representing, apparently, my brother and his wife, who, again, has unquestionable power of attorney over him. I'd like to get a photostat copy of this, or either scan it and put it into a PDF format. The nature inside of this is total bogus as anything you've ever seen. There are so many unquestionable cases which I would demand for the settlement. I'm the executor of the Stanlin Estates. That's both parents. And the fraudulent entries, as you heard before, not to be lengthy, concerning my honorable father, that my brother fraudulently made entry to and didn't give my mother nor me, the real heirs to the estate, not one penny. Trust me, that you've heard so many times in the past. So this is a great opportunity where it comes down, and plenty of time too, to request a trial by jury to set out what I have, prima facie evidences, which are recorded, by the way, in the Register of Deeds, clearly showing a string of felonies, frauds like you could not imagine that could ever take place, and no legitimate yet law firm or entity within this county or other counties that's involved have ever put a case on the docket for this party. He has had these people under the thumb. And in closing, I'll give you some great news to add to this, is that in the last, let's see, Thursday was a week ago, this past Thursday, then go back a week, I had about an hour and 20 or 30 minutes call from the county. It took me, I alluded to this last Monday night, and not to be lengthy here, and it was from the county, new county manager. This county manager, it was almost as if we had a tribunal as the way I presented the facts, documents, right out. I have a photostatic mind. I pulled them right out of the register deeds. Didn't even have no notes before me. Didn't need them. And so when I got through, accordingly, now what's waiting is that county attorney is seeing that they're caught up in fraud in the past and nothing's been done. And even though there's countless, unsurmountable felony charges of for what would be felony charges and for investigation and for probable cause hearings, as I said, have never taken place. Now the county, once I carry these documents up there, they are going to be officially noticed again as many times before. For example, as far back, and I do need to add this, July the 7th, on the 7th of 2003, specifically, I spoke of slander of title. We spoke before the county commissioners. It was written up in the newspapers. That's just one of many occasions that I've addressed this county, and for the law enforcement to come in and for the frauds that are so many of these investigations are, for example, a document that the Shalhoub Police Department has this minute and has had it for a long time. Many other law enforcement, Brunswick County Sheriff Department, New Hanover County Sheriff Department, social services, you name it, has to do with my mother fraudulently, as an elder person, it's called fraudulent elder abuse. I could give you 2 or 3 hours of this. I'm not going to do it because out of other respect here. We have those kind of evidences here that are registered in the social services on two different reports. One of them is 42 minutes, one of them is 45 minutes. We have these documents registered of the investigation reports against Douglas with prima facie evidence in the register of deeds in Brunswick County. let me sure tell you this, the county has caught up, and now we've got this letter here. It's an opportunity to get this resolved, and I can sure tell you there needs to be some motions in closing. This is what I'm asking, and some help, and if you guys will look over this for a motion for continuance and possibly a motion more particularly for previous crimes to be settled, that would be denying my brother from and his schemes here. When you see these paperworks, it's a scheme. We're talking about $102 for 36 months to his attorney. That we're talking about millions and millions. I'm talking about way over in past $600, $800, $1 million. And they're talking about making a payment of $102 to some little peon attorney in Wilmington as to these. And you see these claims in here. And, of course, I'm listed. Myself had to be listed because I'm the executor of the estate. So they have noticed me. This is a golden opportunity, and I'd like for Mr. John Durash to see the documents entirely, very simple, and then the fact of where I would like to request whatever we think's the best, a continuance. Not only that, for claims to be had, but more particularly the reason for the claims to be had or continuous would be for the time to allow the government to get off its, you know what, and where we're talking about North Carolina, we're talking about the federal government, we're talking about revenue in North Carolina department, we're talking about the federal government, and then we're talking back to the basic law enforcement and the county and so forth, et cetera. Various counties, and there's multiple counties where he's defrauded right on into Florida, would you believe? All over North Carolina. You would not believe this mess. So we need to have you guys, please look at this for me, and I would tell you right now, there's no question about it, we're going to have a jury trial. I will tell you in closing, about 10 seconds worth here of what will interest you. There is a document that was served on Douglas, my brother, that's all I'm going to say, and back in time when apparently he had to be considered competent, because this was many, many years ago. He failed to timely so in the 30 days to respond. A sixth grader could have done better. You've heard this before in closing. There is a situation of a $5 million inside of that one-page document, but that's only partial situations of recovery for my parents' estate, which I'm the executor or the trustee, in a sense, from a fiduciary standpoint. That will just not even begin to touch up in the millions of damages that can be recovered as to simply putting a stay on what has just been filed July the 21st. And yes, it says my brother filed this when, in fact, he is supposed to be totally incompetent. And he's totally supposed to have his wife to handle all his affairs. He's a con artist. Make no mistake. So I need your prayers. I need your, and I'd like Mr. Brent, hope Mr. Brent heard every word of this. I'd like to, for you guys to see first-hand copies of this by me going and scanning them, and maybe, just maybe, we can certainly have a better day in America for our sake of my dear parents, if nothing else. My father, in closing, about 10, 20 seconds here, he was in charge of U.S. Customs in Wilmington, a most distinguished and decorated individual. He had unlimited tonnage. He was one that was called out of the Coast Guard to be over into the Navy in World War II to go educate and train the sea captains and officers. Yes, he was involved in Guadalcanal and had a convoy of 11 big, large ships. I'll tell you this in close. My dad, he says, I'm going to tell you something, Dan. He was an iron man. Never talked much about this. He said, I'm going to tell you. He says, Dan, when them Rangers hit that beach, he says they are no question about it, the most fighting men on the planet. And he, tears came completely into his eyes when he told me this. He says, don't, and not only that, the Marines, the Green Beret, the Red Beret, all of them, I mean, I think there's a Black Beret, I'm not sure, for God forgive me. But I'm telling you, especially with all of them there, you think of what we have today. And you think of what has been a disgrace of someone not honoring the Holy Scriptures and being kind to his own mother who had full-fledged dementia, and he defrauded my father while he was in his last days, but my dad didn't have dementia, thank the Heavenly Father. So that's enough for you people out there that's across this land. I need your prayers. I am Dan Stanley out of the Carolinas. This is a opportunity for finally my kids and other of besides me, maybe some parties that might be innocently caught up, that might be debtors somehow or another in this estate that never got paid when Douglas, I'm going to just say Douglas, signed off on 5/21/1990 concerning my father's estate, all of Brunswick County. I leave you with that, and so that fraud has existed. I've complained about it for years, and so now I have to be righting the wrongs for two Stanlin parents and what the my honorable father would expect out of me and my most beloved and distinguished other parent, my mother. And I'll call her appellation. And that is Emma Hazel. Her maiden name was Gore Stanlin. And my father, I'll call his appellation, Schuyler, S-C-H-U-Y-L-E-R, Daniel Stanlin of Brunswick County and also of New Hanover County at the last tour of duty, and then he came precisely to Brunswick County, moved our family. I close right there.
You're muted, Gerard. Brent, did you have anything to say?
Well, I'm here. Can you hear me, Terry? Please.
Yes, I can hear you.
Why, thank you. Well, of course, we are outraged. I am outraged. I'm outraged that people in positions of power don't care about families, don't care about property, don't care about children. They just soon abuse them and to use them for their own profit and purposes, and that's what is going on all over the country. The problem, though, the problem is not them, it's us. We're the problem. And we're the problem because we've allowed this to go on, and we've refused to do what our Maker tells us and confess who we really are. If we will but confess who we really are, if the men of America will humble themselves and pray, then God, he says, will heal our land. The offense that we've committed, the offenses we've committed in such a case, we're talking about inheritance, and that's what he's talking about here. The Bible says that inheritance, true wealth is inherited. No man has anything he hasn't received from above. He received it from above. That means it's an inheritance. It's something given to him. Well, he may think he worked hard for it, but a lot of folk in this world that have worked very hard and have nothing. I came to that realization when I was on the far side of the world. I didn't understand that. But I found out there are a lot of people that work very hard and struggle and strain all their lives and have nothing and never will. But in America, people have been able to have something, but in all cases, whatever you have, it came from your Maker. And to despise that, despise inheritance, despise the inheritance of another person, in this case that Dan's talking about, it has to do with land that's been in the family a long, long time. I mean a long, long time. That's what God says is supposed to pass along to children and grandchildren. I didn't say that. God said that. And isn't it something how that the powers that be, because of our allowance, what we do, number one, in order for all these things to change, do you think that all of our screaming and hollering and cussing and caving and carrying on with indignity and outrage is going to change anything? We're not going to change them. They're evil to the core. What can we change? We can change ourselves. We can humble ourselves and pray. And God says that He'll hear our prayer if we'll but humble ourselves. What does that mean? That means we have to admit that we're wrong, that we have not done what we're supposed to do. And then the Bible says we're supposed to confess the sins of our fathers. They have not done right either. No, we're all in the same boat. We're all equal before the Maker, created equal before the Maker. We're dead in our trespasses and sins. And if we will but acknowledge that, then all these things can change. They won't change by us. We've got to do the right thing. I get it. We all have to do what we can. But we're not the final decider of what will change things. No matter what we do, it's up to our Maker to change them if He wants to. And He's the one we must pay attention to. And we can complain about the evil empire, but one of the things we can do as we're humbling ourselves is to ensure that evil is purged from the land. Evil is purged from the land because if we don't purge the evil from the land, we don't purge it from the land will vomit us out. When I see what's going on around me now, I see what Dan's problem is. I face those problems too. Other people do in varying ways, different things, different ways that evil empire, and the useful idiots come at you. But the bottom line is we must humble ourselves first. And then after we humble ourselves, then we must wait upon the Lord for Him to show us how to apply His standards to the present situation. And we are to do it. And part of that is to purge. But let's don't get it backwards. Let's don't get the idea like the Frenchmen during the French Revolution that they were going to purge evil men from their land. That's what they called it. They called it a purge. You know, like that you were trying to empty your guts. That's what they called it. The French word they use referred to that. Oh, that has to be done. But they had it backwards. They said, we're going to strangle every king with the guts of every priest, and we're going to strangle every priest with the guts of every king. Well, it didn't work. It ended up in a lot of bloodshed, and blood ran in the gutters up to the ankles, and they were chopping men's heads off without due process of law. Now, we're the problem first. We got to clean our own back porch first. Have you cleaned your back porch? Or is it a mess? Clean it up. And after you clean it up, God will show you what to do. He'll show you when to move and how to move. But relax and make sure you get yourself first. But the injustices, for example, of which Dan complains, are the result of a long many years of evil. We've allowed it for a long many years, and we haven't said anything. We haven't humbled ourselves. We just keep screaming and hollering in outrage. Outrage is the easiest thing to work up in politics. It's easy. That's why you see all the talk show hosts, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, and who else is there out there? Levine. All they know how to do is stir up moral outrage, and that's all they do. But when do they say, you're the problem? God's people are the problem. The ones that know better are the problem. I talked to a young man tonight. He's in an awful pickle. He got a girl pregnant. She had a baby. He followed her out west. He was from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he's trying to take care of his son. And some of the things that I said to him, I'm an older man now, but some of the things that I said to him, he'd never heard of. Simple things. He doesn't even know. Nobody ever told him. Nobody ever told him how the country started. Nobody ever told him who started the country. And his father was a professor of English, and he's an intelligent, astute man. The things he told me, I was amazed. He taught me things. But he was, as Paul the Apostle says, ever learning, never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Just keep piling up knowledge upon knowledge, puffing up his brain, But he doesn't understand the first principles of the standards of the maker of all things, the true lawgiver, true law, what is right and what is wrong. How do you start? You start first with yourself. You must humble yourself. What does that mean? You must agree with your maker that you have broken his laws and you are an habitual lawbreaker. And once you do that, and that becomes the habit of your life, as you're doing that, really you never stop. But as you're doing that, get that habit. And then God will show you what to do. But if you won't admit that, he'll never show you what to do in individual instances, and things in America won't change. Back to you, Terry, if you're there, or Gerard, whoever is able to make noise on the mic.
Oh, I'm giving it to Gerard.
Okay. If he's there.
No, I'm here. I just had to find my button. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. Well, there you go. That was a very good answer because, like you said, we all having the same problems now, aren't we? We hear them over and over again, and that is the answer. And once in a while, you get one of them guys like Sean Hannity to go there. I've heard him, not Sean so much, but the other guy there. What's his name? The other Fox guy. He tends to bring God into it a little bit more. You know what I mean?
Tucker Carlson
seems to be a little bit more spiritual in the whole thing, you know. We need more of that. We really do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, Dan, I'm going to look at, I don't know if you sent any of that paperwork over. You should, so we could just at least look at it. I don't know if there's anything else we can tell you as far as all the craziness you got going on here, but we'd sure be glad, you know, we'd look at it for you anyway and see if something pops out. Okay.
Yes, sir. I will tell you this, that there, and I didn't mention this, apparently filing spouse, husband and wife, brother and sister-in-law, even though he's got dementia, and I don't see how he could assign these documents or how this could be of any validity, but it is a Chapter 13. And you will be interested to know that back in time, there was a situation where there was a 13, Chapter 13, put into place to safeguard against what my brother back in those days and several others, his partners inside of our family, believe it or not, violated and... in business, and my parents were supposed to receive like $15,000 in a particular court document. I'm quoting this clearly by a former bankruptcy case with a Chapter 13, and these parties, especially Douglas and the powers to be in the county, proceeded on and violated that Chapter 13, and it had to do with protection of a 176.1700s, two highway road frontages in Brunswick County, a portion of my inheritance. And there was an SBA loan involved, and this property was used to finance a daycare enclosing on Mulberry Street, still in existence today, and is called for kids only of Shalote. Nevertheless, I'm telling you that Douglas and his powers were circumvented the integrity of a former Chapter 13 bankruptcy that was held, the case in Kempston, North Carolina, for protection, and now he is filing a Chapter 13 and paying $102 a month for 36 months to this attorney when we're talking about well past $600-800 million or better, way probably past that. I tell you, this is a farce, and for him to sign these papers, I want you guys to look at this. We've got plenty of time here. I want you to see this from the standpoint that I believe there's sufficient evidence that I have that in the register deeds concerning a court transcript where Douglas was caught in fabricating a POA against my mother. I'm going to close right here. There's so many things I could tell you. It'd take 2 or 3 hours. But right here, I have the evidence of this. where the transcript shows that Douglas was caught fabricating a POA on my mother. She had dementia at the time. Then there's another case in there, again, certified documents in the Register of Deeds in Brunswick County, where the North Carolina Real Estate Commission came down against Douglas. I'm not going to call all his appellation out back in time, and he was supposed to be completely, I don't know what the best word you could describe it, to be not allowed whatsoever to any kind of dealings in real estate. He's not stopped. Mm-hmm. He's in violation. He is a nuisance. He's put so much mess in our register deeds up there of untruth and deeds. That's why I had to speak 7-7-2003 while my mother was living. I'm closing right here before the Brunswick County former county commissioners. There was a county attorney present and law enforcement and everything else. Nothing been done. Slander of title from the very get-go of my brother stealing the titles, especially of a home where my mother, was legal. It was a legal residence for her. I could go on and on with this, where he used this fraudulent POA to steal countless amounts of wealth from certain banks that were right in the heart of Shaloke, North Carolina, Brunswick County, and is now those banks have fraud teams. There's too much here, and never has there been any. So how can they have, here's the question, how can they have a situation to give Douglas all this when, in fact, all the mess they've got on the paper right now is completely fraud to him, reported to him by his attorneys or his wife, and without these other cases, it sets the title of precedence to be heard first. So I want to demand a jury trial and for probable cause hearings that will run the course and with sufficient evidence. I hope you understand this. I'd like to get this over for you, Mr. John Durash and Gerard. Thank you for this time and all the other parties that would be important there with research, but and especially hopefully Mr. Brent Allen Winters will also look these. It's very simple documents, very simple.
Okay. Thank you very much. And we will look at that. And all I could say is, like Brent says, this is because men don't take care of their own backyards. And that's why when one bad apple can move through this system, because nobody else is clean enough to catch him or wants to. It's an endemic problem. And if he would have been stopped a long time ago, but you don't want
to.
I said if there was any good people out there, he would have been stopped. But you see, they don't care.
I want you to know I know procedure and law, and I want you to know that there's so many other areas of legal briefs that are in my mother's file at this very minute tonight. And there have been sent countless of these to the Attorney General when the local area officers were not performing their duties. Trust me, if there's ever been a word that I can send that rings a 100,000-word essay, is this. Dan Stanlon has preserved back in time, and this statute of limitations and all this clock stuff is bullcrap anyway, but I, on so many unbelievable fronts, with so many signed criminal complaints, we're talking about even inside of the veterans file in Bolivia, documents there, where Douglas is caught there missing and stealing my mother's CDs back in time that was granted to her. And yes, in closing, would you believe he stole all of the life insurance, of two life insurance policies, with my mother the beneficiary. Then he filed and closed on May the 21st, I believe it is, of the register of 1990, My father died June 10th of 1990, and on May the 21st, he filed 16 pages and a pure file Chapter 13 trash. Never paid the federal government, never paid the state of North Carolina, more particularly did not pay my beloved mother at that time or either his own brother, the true heir, and along with any heirs. But no, sir, his heirs have been given houses and almost Rolls Royce, but Mercedes and everything else on the book. He's traveled all over the world on this estate. Trust me, I can tell you that we have preserved and made a reservation for rights. I hope Brent heard this.
Well, I'm here, Dan. I'm here.
Well, thank you, sir.
Okay, Dan. Thank you.
And thank you, guys.
Yep.
You've got to move on to some other people now. I know that.
Yep. Can I scream now? No. Okay.
Yes, sir, you can, and I'll get this out to you. I'll go get it professionally in a PDF format. Thank you, guys, for this consideration. And, yes, I do understand Brent's kind suggestions, and yours too, Brent. I understood exactly, because that is what the Heavenly Father expects of us. And so he was paraphrasing the authority of all authorities, our Heavenly Father. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Ashley.
Ready, because they say that August is going to be a hot summer.
I got you unmuted there.
That's
Ashley.
What it is. So I think it is going to begin.
You ain't going to get fast.
Hello. You're unmuted. You're on. You're on the air.
Motherfucking jump.
Going to be.
Okay.
Oh, man.
See, I'll be back. Hold on. I'll be back. Hello.
Yes, this is Ashley.
Hi.
Hey, you're on the
Hi,
air.
Hi, Rod. How you doing?
Good. What's going on?
I've been working on this affidavit for the Kansas Department of Revenue, and I'm going to get ready to send it out. But I need to ask a question about should I address the affidavit to the governor and the secretary's names on the letter they sent me, or should I just address it to the Department of Revenue?
Yeah, I'm not sure on that one, which I'm not familiar with the document you sent. They sent you...
It was a notice of assessment of the taxes for 2015.
Right,
and they say that I owe them taxes $1,900 from the income of $50,000, which I know I didn't get that.
Right.
and they gave me like 60 days to respond, and but you know I'm doing the affidavit and I'm just demanding them. Go ahead.
I would send it to multiple people. It's not going to hurt. You know what I mean? I would address it to multiple people, but I don't know if you discussed this with John at all as far as them when they're assessing you taxes. There are certain things that you need to make sure you do and say. You know what I mean? I mean, they got to have.
Yeah, I know he told me, I asked him if I should ask them for the proof of payment. He said,
right.
Yes, I need to request that, those two forms, the 4490 and, you know.
Right, do it quickly because that's a pretty good one that they never have. The more you answer them, the more chance you got to get in trouble with them, you know. It's better to tell them to, you know, they got to produce that. And when you ask that, then they'll know you know something. It's going to put them in a different tack than just steamrolling over you, because they will, and they'll move you from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I would get that out immediately, sooner rather than later. You know, and as far as who you address it to, I don't know specifically, but usually it's better that they know that more people are looking at it. I think, in my mind, it's better that it's addressed to more people rather than less people. You know what I mean?
The governor and the secretary's name is on that letter they sent me, the notice of assessment. So
right.
That's the only two name I saw, but I can put probably address it to the commissioner or something.
Yeah, you can address it to the commissioner, but you can carbon copy them too. I mean, they put the governor's name on it. What's that supposed to intimidate you?
Right. Okay.
You know what I mean?
I would
address it to them too, and you know, I don't want to say, you know, they're all in on it, you know. And I mean, if they're going to use
right.
the governor's name, he's in on it too. You know what I mean?
Okay. Right.
So.
And then I got two more other questions real quick, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead. We're kind of out of time, but I'll tell you, you got in, so go ahead.
Oh, okay. The other thing, I don't know if I should send the file on demand, that affidavit file on demand, or just send my affidavit and a proof of service, affidavit of service, and that's it.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. You don't know whether to
send do I need to use another form of to be on with my affidavit, like I think the NLA has the file on demand. I think that's an affidavit. Do I need that with my affidavit, or just send my affidavit by itself?
Think you could send the affidavit. Did you go through the affidavit form and fill it out like
mm-hmm.
with Jim? Did you talk to Jim and you followed it the way he did?
I sent one to James, but I haven't. He hasn't responded to me, but you know, so I don't know.
Did you give them a file on demand already?
No. Uh-uh.
No. I don't know that you need it. You know what I mean?
I was just asking. So
I think you could send the affidavit in. I don't know that you need a file on demand with that particular document, you know. So I would do that, but get those other papers in there quick, because that's what's going to, if anything's going to change the direction, that will or that should, you know. But like we said, they're evil, so who knows what they'll do, you know what I mean? Sometimes you can't guess what they're going to do, even if you think you got a ace in the hole, because they're ignorant.
Yeah.
And
right.
like Thornton says, there's nothing so frightful as ignorance in action. And believe me, they can be very ignorant, and they can be very frightful too. So just be careful, you know. Okay?
Let's see. I was trying to see if one more question that I had. I can't. Okay. Oh, okay, never mind. I don't need to ask that question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate
much.
It. Thank
yeah.
you so much.
You have a
okay,
good night.
Okay, have a good night.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Selena from Kansas, go ahead. We're out of time, but I'm going to take another one since we went so long.
Just a comment, a quick comment about the McCloskey and St. Louis incident. I did talk to a person in St. Louis, and like they're saying, there is two sides to the story, and that they didn't break the gate. And I mean, I don't know, you know, they didn't
mm-hmm.
break the gate. It was unlocked, and they went through, and they were on the way to the mayor's house. And I hadn't heard you saying that. I just thought I'd mention this.
I thought I read that someplace, too. Somebody had said that. Then they showed a picture of a mangled gate, so I don't know.
I know exactly. I saw the same. Maybe it was unlocked and they just threw it aside. But also, I know that I talked just one more point in Aurora with the Elijah McClain protest, and another, like there are good protesters, Black Lives Matter people, and it's such a switch into the rougher element that comes in, and I think there's a lot of, you know, finagling going on.
No doubt.
Undercut both on both sides. I just wanted to say that. And those are some people that are on site. Okay.
Right,
thank
right.
you.
Thanks a lot. And your point is well taken, okay?
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, Sarah from L.A., Louisiana.
Louisiana, yes. So thanks for taking me. I know we're short on time. But I just wanted to give a little feedback. I think that everybody who is trying to do their court cases are really asserting their constitution that doesn't apply to them because they are, in the eyes of the court, the system that we have now, they're not entitled to those constitutional rights because they're U.S. citizens, and so they're considered a corporation. So I think that without a affidavit of corporate denial, that's why their cases aren't very successful. When you submit an affidavit of corporate denial, you at least separate yourself from the corporation that they're actually going after and they're actually suing. And that holds a lot of power from the research that I've done. It really changes the game because they realize that you understand that they are just going after a corporation, a trust, a bond, and it's all about money, even criminal cases, especially family cases. All of these cases are going after an entity and not an actual person. So unless you assert your, position and that you're not, you're a living, breathing, self-aware, conscious soul, you're not going to get a whole lot of, success.
Yeah, I understand exactly. I understand what you're saying. And look, at every paper we ever put in, we always rebut the presumption. We always put it in common law. We don't give credibility to the fiction because, look, those are our courts. We don't care what they said or what illegal action that they put in there to take us over and say we were we go in and we rebut the presumption that we're this corporate thing, and they still don't care because they know we're right, but they're not going to, especially they're not going to give us credibility if they don't have to. We have to, you know what I mean? They're gonna wait till the last minute. They know we're right, and we've done exactly what you're talking about, and they don't care either, because if they acquiesce to us, they lose everything. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they're so outside of the law. There's no magic word you can say to them that's going to make them fix things. And they're schooled in this stuff to a higher up ones. They understand. That's how they sleep at night. They say, well, they're contracted in because they got a driver's license. They got this and they got that. That's all baloney to help them sleep at night. Look, Hitler did the same thing when he took over. He rewrote laws to make the atrocities that he was doing legal. Did that make them legal because he rewrote the law? Heck no. It's smoke and mirrors is all it is. And they know that we know what the game is. And if they're not bending to us, and we're an organization, of over 7,000-8,000 people, and even more. I mean, that's what we have listed, and we got a following greater than that. And they're not. Imagine you going in as yourself and saying, "Well, I'm not that corporation and stuff." You're a little tiny voice going beep 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 beep, and they don't care. So that's why there's some power in all of us doing the same thing. Look, we're making a record. And they're afraid to throw it out. They told us, don't file any more papers. We file them anyway, and guess what? They put them in because some clerk got our paperwork, and we said, look, if you take this out, you're going to be subject to fines. Well, it finally looks like those fines could happen on top, and they're scared. And so the clerks won't even listen to the judge and not file it. So we are making headway, whether you know it or not. I mean, we can't always see it up front. But what's going to happen is that curtain's going to tear from the top to the bottom. It's going to open up, and this thing is going to break all at once. That's my prediction anyway. That's what I'm waiting for. It's in God's time. It's not in our time. And we know all the little tricks, just like you're saying. We know what they did to get us here, and it was really to get themselves here because they had to, in their own mind, they came up with all this magic stuff. All this UCC stuff that they use, all this business of balancing the scales and, you know, and all equity and all that. They did that for themselves, so they feel comfortable robbing you, sending you to your grave poor, because that's all it's about. It's all about the money, really, and that's, you know, that's where you can come up and say, you know, money, the root of all evil. Well, it's the love of money. It's not money. It's the love of money, the root of all evil. And the other problem that they have is they've been so controlled and they've been so picked. They're like the mob. You don't get into the mob unless you're made. You got to kill somebody. They got to have it on tape. So these judges that you're talking about that we're sending paperwork into, they're all made men mostly. And that's what Trump is trying to clean up. How do you get justice out of a guy like that? He's not going to give little old you justice when they're standing there with a bigger gun than you and saying, don't you dare. That's what they're telling him, don't you dare. So this is what we're up against. Even when we understand the smoke and mirrors, how do you break through that? It has to be by the force of the people. And when enough people, when our cry goes to heaven enough and God says enough is enough, they're going to all fall in one day. You know what I mean? It says in the Bible, in that day he will slay Leviathan. And you know what that day means? It means, it doesn't mean in eternity, it means in time. So you and I, we're in time, and we're in the courts, and we're in time. And so we're going to, if we live long enough, we're going to see that day. And it's coming. I think it's coming, and it's going to be here soon. And there's a lot of movement going on right now, so... For the first time in my lifetime, we actually have the top coming down to meet us. We've got to bring the bottom up and meet them. And when that happens, then these guys will fall. And we know who they are. And one of the things we're doing is it's on record. It's a record. I think there's going to be a great purging. I don't know how they're going to handle it. I wouldn't want to have to sort it out because it's a mess. I mean, look at Dan from North Carolina. Look at all the stuff he went through. That's one person. And, you know, the most vicious stuff that's out there is in families, believe it or not. Families are so vicious with each other, that's what the problem with the country is, because we've lost our family, you know, loyalty and love. And it says in the latter days, men's hearts will grow cold. Well, that's what this is all about. Men's hearts are cold.
Right, you know? That's definitely happened. But I think that until that day comes, our family courts especially are really tainted, because when you apply for a marriage license, you're giving the products of your marriage over to these corrupt entities. And until people realize that the marriage license isn't required, you don't have to give your kids over to this corrupt government, then
even if you did that, they required it. It was fraud. And you
That's
can come
true.
Back at any time and say,
right.
Look, what you did to me was fraud. And we've done it. When we go in, we say, look, we're not that person who you think we are. So right there, we're rebutting their presumption. And, I mean, knowing what I know now, there's a lot of stuff I wouldn't do. You know, look, I went into business working on cars, and I just put a sign out, and I started working on cars. Well, it turns out in my state, well, in every state now, I think it is, if you don't have a license from the state, you can't do it. It's not legal. You can't charge people to work on cars unless you apply for a license from the state. So I started, and I worked for the better part of a year or something, and then something happened, and they came in. They said, oh, you're working on cars without a license and blah, blah, blah. And I said, why do I need a license? How can you license that? You know, a license is something that gives you permission to do something that would normally be against the law. Why would working on a car be against the law? Well, you can't charge people and blah, blah, blah. So they made me get a license. They fined me, and they said, if you get your license within 30 days, we'll cut the fine in half. And that's what I did. I got my license, and I paid half the fine. So at some point, now at least I have evidence that I went in without a license. That's good for me, because that's, you see, back when I did that 30 years ago, whatever it was, I knew I didn't want a license, but they forced me into it. So when I go to get rid of this license eventually, when the time is right, when things are going good, I'm going to say, look, I didn't do it. You made me do it. You came in. You sent an investigator in, and, you know, and they told me, they said, you know, we can hold you to this and that. I had a complaint on a car. This guy went nuts, and he took his car out before I was done with it, and then he filed with the state. And they said, well, you should have done this or that. I said, I couldn't do this or that because he took the car. And I said, besides that, how can you hold me to your rules when I don't have your license? They said, oh, no, we can't. Now I find out when you go on their website, it says, and you're going to make a complaint against somebody who worked on your car or garage. They said, no, we only have a limited amount of stuff that we could do to somebody that doesn't hold our license. You see, when they came after me, they told me, oh, we can hold you to that. We can make you pay for the repair that he did, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't true. They lied to me. So they've right. even learned, you know what I mean? They've learned that I wasn't, see, technically when they came in here, I wasn't under their jurisdiction. I didn't take their license. So how can they hold me? See, if I was smarter in the law, I would have held their feet to the fire and said, oh, no, you know? But they said, oh, no, we could do that, and we could take your driver's license away. I mean, what's my driver's license got to do with working on cars? But that's the game that they play, you see? So we all have to educate ourselves, and we have to come to this place. It's coming. It's coming more and more, and as people go in and push, you know, it'll come to pass. Look, even though people may be filing stuff and it may not be perfect, it's pressure, and they understand. You know, they've gotten along this long because every time there was too much pressure, the pressure cooker valve would let the pressure out. They always did, you know, one step backwards, two steps forward. Right now, it looks like there's no backwards for them, so they're really putting the pedal to the metal, and this is going to be their demise because there is no the pressure valve is no longer working. In other words, they don't care. They want what they want, and they want it now, and they want to put us under their thumb, and there's some very terrible things that are coming that we need to resist, and you know, like if they do this mandatory vaccination, that's the mark of the beast. I don't care what anybody says. It's going to be tracking. It's going to change your DNA. You won't even be human anymore. It's going to make a permanent change to your DNA. They're going to be able to adjust it electronically. They're going to be able to update it. They're going to adjust you so that you either walk over there or you die. So you're not going to be able to buy or sell or get food or do anything unless you do what they say. So this is it. If we don't resist this, we're done. I'm telling you, they can taste it. They are so close now. And I think their demise is going to be that they've waited this long. Look, this has been going on since before 1700. These guys have had their fingers in our banking and everything else. And there was something, I think it was Wendell House or something, and he said, and this was back in the turn of the century, and he said, we will get their biometric data, and they won't even realize that we own them. And this was before we knew what biometric data meant. Way back when. I mean, this is the devil himself. You know what I mean? How could they talk about biometric data in 1890 or something like that, right? That was not even something that was in our minds, but it was certainly in Satan's mind. And this guy laid it out perfectly and exactly what's going on today. So just beware. You know, look, at this papers in the court is the least of our problems right now. We need to stop them with this fake pandemic and this fake masking and all this fraud that they're putting us through. And this is just a test to see how brainwashed they have us. I see people driving around with masks in their car, the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. You got to go in the restaurant with your mask on. You take it off when you sit down. When the waitress comes back on, you put it on. This is all exercise in mind control. You know, I'm going to tell you something. That mask says I will comply. I'm up on this stuff, believe me. The science says the mask will kill you. You shouldn't be wearing it. Healthy people don't need masks. The worst thing you can do is quarantine healthy people, and that's exactly what they're doing because they're trying to lower our herd of immunity. And all it is a sign of which side you're on. It's going to come to the point where they know who's on their side by the mask. Now, if you've got a health condition, you can say, I have a health condition that precludes me from wearing a mask, right? I called up Walmart, and I was going to complain. They said they're not going to accept cash because there's a coin shortage. And I checked all the banks in the areas, and there was no coin shortage. So I was going to call up and complain and say, who do you think you're kidding? Because I can go to any bank over here and get coins. because this is a, you know, they're going to bring in the cashless society now. It's all in one big ice cream cone here between the virus and the vaccination and the tracking and the chipping and the cashless society. All at once it's coming, and they can taste it. And I said to them, you know, I have a health condition. I can't wear a mask. They said, oh, well, we got these black shirt people you go see. They'll help you. We'll facilitate you and all this stuff. I read this one article. The woman said, I found the black shirt lady, and she told me, wear your mask around your neck. Can you imagine? Just go in, but put the mask around your neck. Now, I rest my case. It's just a symbol. It's like the stars that Hitler put on the Jews' arms so he could identify them. This is to tell them who you are. And so...
That's true. And, you know, it's really scary how people really are complying. My daughter is going to Benjamin Franklin High School. That's a charter high school here in New Orleans, and it's one of the top 50 schools in the country as far as the best schools. And in this parent meeting that we had, of course, all online, it was a town hall parent meeting, I was just shocked by all of the people who were asking questions. The students and the parents and teachers were all just asking about compliance and how are they going to enforce masks and how are they going to make sure that social distancing is enforced. And I was just so shocked by how many people were demanding enforcement. And during the later part of the conference, the lady said, well, let me get this, I want to get your opinion, take this survey question. And so we all answered some survey questions, and she said, well, you see, this is the beautiful part of a democracy, that we can all put our opinion in. And I started typing, because we can all leave feedback, that, you know, don't y'all teach history? We're not a democracy. We're not supposed to be a democracy. We're supposed to be a Republican form of government. And that's, you know, one of the best 50 schools in the country, and they are pushing this wonderful free country of democracy that we have. It's really scary to see that everybody is so brainwashed into that.
It's all a fraud. You know where social distancing comes from? And I'll end with this. Social distancing, there's no scientific proof behind social distancing. It was a high school science fair project. It's never been proven. And I got more information on the whole mask, how they don't work. Look at OSHA guidelines tells you on each type of mask, and the cloth mask is the worst one, the absolute worst. The N95 doesn't filter anything coming out. You got somebody with a disease coughing out of N95. It only filters coming in. It's meant for contaminated environments. And a surgical mask is meant for for sterile environments, not for, you know, out in the public. And people are taking these masks on and off. All it is a virus petri disc is what it is. And you're breathing, you're going to make yourself sick because you're breathing your own. And they go on the mask and they multiply and you breathe them back in. We had one girl up here, the linings of her lungs sloughed off because she was such a germaphobic. She didn't take that mask off and she wore it so much and suffered so much. Now, a lot of times they just pass out, but she actually got mold in her because her mask was, the mold was growing. But we got to go because we're way over. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And one more thing real quick is that also I think it's a subliminal sign to get people to be afraid, and really a subconscious thing to make people afraid. Like you see masks everywhere. It's all required. It's a scare tactic. But good night. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you all next week.
God bless.
You too.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.